All right, it's on.
Mr. McKenna, we're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission in Washington. We are a bipartisan commission set up by Congress to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. Do you consent to this interview being recorded?
I do consent.
Great, thank you. As I mentioned, we're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. For purposes of the audio, if the persons here could just say their name and spell their last name. I'm Brad Bondi, B-O-N-D-I.
Tom Stanton, S-T-A-N-T-O-N, from the commission.
Kim Schaefer from the commission, S-H-A-F-E-R.
Charlie Gambino from the Deutsche Bank Legal Department.
Patrick McKenna, M-C-K-E-N-N-A. I'm with the Risk Department, Deutsche.
It's Walter Ricciardi, R-I-C-C-I-A-R-D-I, with Paul Weiss.
Andrew Levy, L-E-V-Y, with Paul Weiss.
Great, thank you. Ms. McKenna, I'm obligated to tell you that because we're with the government, the typical rules apply, like 18 U.S.C. 1001, meaning it's a crime to knowingly or willfully provide false or misleading information to us, although I have no reason to believe that you're not going to be truthful to us today. I'm just obligated to put you on notice to that. And I will turn things over to my colleague, Mr. Stanton, who would like to ask you about the risk management practices at Deutsche Bank.
Reading your financials, you guys seem to have emerged relatively well. Is that a fair statement?
I would say that's a fair statement, yes.
Can we start maybe with your background, how long you've been in this position, and then the question is, when did you first realize that markets were behaving unusually?
Okay. My current position is fairly new. I was recently appointed the Chief Risk Officer for Deutsche Bank for the Americas, and that's a new assignment, effective, in fact, at the beginning of this month, August. But I have had, over a number of years at Deutsche, very senior credit risk positions, and in fact was responsible for covering all of the financial institutions globally and hedge funds during the crisis that we've gone through over the last 2 to 3 years. I had, in addition to that, responsibilities subsequent to the crisis for securitization globally, private wealth management globally, and then last fall took on the emerging markets as well. But for the purposes of the financial crisis, my role really during that was to be the senior credit risk manager for financial institutions globally and for hedge funds.
Okay.
And I've got many years of experience in banking, over 30 years, in fact, and I arguably could say from every aspect of banking, from the retail all the way up through to the most sophisticated investment banking products. Most of my career early on was on the client-facing side, but more recently, since 1998, I've been on the risk side.
At Deutsche Bank this entire time?
No, a few different firms. I was with UBS for 15 years, and then I moved to Deutsche Bank in March of 2001 and was there for 3 years, moved to Barclays Capital, and I was there for nearly 3 years and rejoined Deutsche Bank in January of 2007.
Just in time.
Yes.
And that's the point at which you were the credit risk officer.
For when I rejoined Deutsche, I took over initially the responsibilities for the regional, for the North America credit, regional head of credit. And then a couple weeks into my return, I was appointed the global head of hedge fund credit. And then about six, 9 months in that time frame, we restructured our credit businesses, and I became the global head of financial institutions and hedge funds.
Great. So when did it occur to you the markets were behaving unusually?
I would say there was already some signals in the market, late 2006, I think the big headline was when HSBC came out and announced they were seeing significant increase in their delinquencies for their mortgage book in the U.S. And I think that was the first signal that people focused on in terms of uncertainty around the housing market. Nobody or including myself, had any idea as to what did that really mean, other than it just came as the first signal, I think, looking now back, of what would have been the first warning sign in the markets of the housing market. My first day on the job of the global hedge fund role, there was some turmoil in Turkey, and the stock market had sold off, I think, 10%, and immediately had to scramble to see what hedge fund clients had exposure to Turkey, and we run regular stress tests, but we ran whenever there was a crisis or some kind of market disruption, we'd run another ad hoc stress test to see what further declines in the market would have. So my first day on the job, and that wasn't related to the housing market, but it kind of taught me early on the need to be able to move quickly and manage, you know, where potential volatility was in the market. My that would have been in February 2007.
If we can stop there for one sec and then go on. What did you do, and how did who respond? I'm interested in the relationship of the risk function to the business function, call it.
Well, the risk function at Deutsche is totally independent from the business, so there's no authority that they can do in terms of trading or client exposures unless they come up through the risk organization. So what we did at that time is the first thing to do is just assess the situation and also stress the portfolio to see who was vulnerable to further gapping in terms of prices. So we ran a stress test across the whole hedge fund portfolio just to see, and specifically targeted towards this particular event, the Turkish market, and determined who was more vulnerable. Now the markets came back, and there was no significant action that we had to take as far as cut any limits or anything along that line. It was just more kind of understanding the fundamentals of what the who was at risk. Mm-hmm. At that time. But that was, again, baptism by fire. My first experience is the day I literally started as the head of globally for hedge funds. And then there were a number of other markets during that period that were having some disruptions. I think another example was the price differential between the A and H shares in the Hong Kong China market. There was some moves there that were not in line with what I think would have been normal, and we had to look at some of those issues. And then there was it seemed like one thing after the other, but nothing that you would say would give you any foresight necessarily to what we were really about to witness the following 2 years. But I'd say the first real signs were starting already in the spring of 2007 with what was happening with the mortgage prices and in terms of where they were moving, the subprime, the Alt-A, the structured credit. The prices started to show signs of volatility and decline already in April timeframe of 2007. And then I would say the real first counterparty that we experienced on the hedge fund side that had significant issues was the Bear Stearns hedge funds, and we were right in the heart of that. We had exposure to both of the BSAM hedge funds. On the one that was lower levered, we actually net owed them money, and on the more levered fund, we actually had a small deficit. It was about $6 million, I recall. So what we were able to do is we were able to negotiate a termination agreement with them to pay them out on the one fund and actually have them pay us a termination fee on the other fund that they owed us some money.
And what was the risk function in that process?
We pretty much took over. We were in charge of the whole management of the negotiation, and also leading up to that, of course, there was a lot more volatility in the asset prices, and we would be involved in making the margin calls. We have a separate margin department that makes the calls, but when the margins are not met, the credit department plays an active role in calling the client and finding out what's happening, and then also negotiating with the client to get the additional margin in. The hedge fund world's a bit different than a lot of other areas of banking, because the client faces off more with the credit department than it does with the trading areas as it relates to their portfolio, the margin tiering, and discussions around the hedge fund market as a whole doesn't want the traders to have any real idea of what their positions are, so they provide much more confidential information into the credit departments of banks than they do into any other area, in fact. And most of the discussions and negotiations that take place with around margin and around margin disputes and missed margin calls get done by the credit department.
So do you have a sense of the bank and its reactions at this point to what they were seeing in the market and through their various lines of business?
You mean the broader banks as a whole?
Yeah, the Deutsche Bank writ large is a huge enterprise.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I'll give an example. It's clear from a variety of sources, including popular ones, that you had some people that were going short on mortgages. Other people were not. And one of my questions is, did the bank know that?
There are, I'm sure, at a level within the bank, people knew that there were strong views on certain desks. That I think at that point it was known. I mean, we in this area, for example, with the Bear Stearns hedge funds, wasn't something that we were thinking, oh, we're short on another side. We were focused just on managing the risk that we had against Bear. And what you saw was the market's prices declining very quickly right around that time. And what really drove that was a number of banks looked at their portfolios, and particularly as it related to Bear at this time, and had provided financing on the whole basis of how that market works, is that you have margin that you take in, and you take in sufficient levels of margin to cover you for what's known as the gap risk of the positions moving before you can get more margin, and if they do decline. And I think what happened with Bear was the market, there was uncertainty around the prices, and then in addition to that, people weren't completely sure of where the market was going to go if everybody was flooding at the same time trying to liquidate a portfolio. So it created even more volatility around the asset prices, and I think what you saw was, right around Bear, a significant move in the underlying RMBS prices that they, particularly the subprime assets that they financed. Now, were we conscious of that Deutsche Bank, somebody was taking a position? Yes, I would say somebody was conscious of the view, the positions that were being put on in terms of the view of you know, some of the part of the institution that had in about the market, yes. But I'm not.
You know, you wouldn't have known if somebody set limits or changed limits or did something at that point to sort of deal with volatility in the market.
Yeah, for me personally, at that time, me personally, no, I didn't know that. There, the chief risk officer of the bank may have known that. I don't know. I can't speak for him. The head of our global markets business, I'm sure, would have had a knowledge of somebody having a view on the markets and what their positions were. Personally, I did not. I was not aware of that.
If I understand your question correctly, you're asking questions relating to trading limits being placed on trading.
For example, or you can talk to some people, and I mean, there's a famous quote about getting closer to home. The markets are volatile, so we want to change positions.
Well, Patrick, why don't you talk about sort of the risk function from the front office perspective?
Right. Okay, that's sure. There was. Clearly, within the global markets business itself, each global markets business has their own risk function within the business. We're outside the risk function in terms of making commitment of capital or setting up the trading limits is independent from the business, and that's the area that I sit in. But the business itself, each of the businesses have their own risk managers as well as it relates to counterparty risk and just balance sheet usage and so forth. And Deutsche clearly in this time frame, already starting in the spring, was very, very aware and I'd say looking at our own just the positions that we took on became very focused on de-risking the portfolio. And if you look at why did Deutsche do better than I think a lot of the other banks, already starting from the spring of 2007, we started to look at de-risking our our riskier assets, let's say, in our trading, you know, our prop trading positions. And so we did a significant de-risking from the spring of 2007 through through the end of 2007. You could see where we had reduced our risk considerably during that period of time. Now, we didn't miss all the hits, of course, but we, because of the proactive, and that came from the business itself, and from the head of our global markets business, was very much focused on seeing a lot of uncertainty in the market and having the riskier parts of the portfolio de-risk during that period.
So it was a business decision almost.
It was clearly a business decision. I'm sure he was speaking with Hugo Banzinger, our chief risk officer, and there's very frequent interaction, of course, with senior management. But a large part of the de-risking that took place in the global market side of the bank was directed from the very top of the business itself.
When we've talked with firms or studied firms that have a risk sensitivity on the business side, it's usually because something really bad happened to them in the 1990s and they, so to speak, got religion. Is that the story here or is it something else?
I can't speak for why, because I'm not sure what the experiences were for this individual, I can say that he's very risk aware. We have our culture at Deutsche is the first line of defense is the business itself. I mean, they are expected to be our first risk managers. Again, we have an independent risk function, but these are the guys bringing in the clients, bringing in the transactions, and so the expectation is that they should be all very much risk aware and focused, and that they're the first line of defense for the firm in terms of, again, the counterparties or the types of business that we're putting on our books. It's not to say you have 100% everybody that thinks that way, but that's definitely, you know, part of the ingrained culture for Deutsche Bank. In terms of what led to the behavior of the de-risking and was it from a historic, I can't speak to what might have motivated, you know, that decision. I'm sure all these individuals have a lot of experience, and they've been through a number of different cycles. So I'm sure that would have had an influence on their, you know, their response.
And who was the chief business officer you were thinking about?
Well, the head of the global markets is Anshu Jain.
How do I spell it? Sorry.
Anshu is A-N-S-H-U, and Jain is J-A-I-N.
And he's the one who made the, at least at the leadership position, made the decision to de-risk.
Well, within the head of our global markets, he heads it up, so he would be the one, yes.
Interesting.
Just with likely the consultation of his group.
Oh no doubt. I mean,
he didn't make a decision.
Oh, absolutely.
He's got a group of high-level people around him.
No, that's right. He's got a whole central management team of people that he works with, and people that are risk managers for him within his business. And then in addition to that, he's also consulting Dr. Ackerman, you know, our CEO, and as well as Hugo Banzinger, the chief risk officer. I'm sure they're having consultations and discussions around this. But he would have been, from the business side, the general giving the instructions to de-risk the portfolio.
But if I hear you right, it's almost as if the risk officer didn't need to tell him to A, pay attention, and B, do something.
I would say he certainly he didn't need to be told, no, I would say. Meaning that he acted on his own in addition to having his other people who were speaking to him. But it's not he's an independent, and he directed a de-risking of the book because I think he had some concerns of where the business was going, particularly around the more structured credit businesses.
And on what continent is he located?
He sits in London.
Maybe interesting to call him up if that were possible, just to get a sense of the cultural issues and sort of why the sensitivity. And I don't know if you can answer this question, but it's always... We're always curious when somebody starts to trim risk, de-risk, does the compensation of the people on the front lines go up or down according to the way their compensation is determined? In other words, do they fight it or do they accept it because they have the financial incentive?
Right. I can't address that.
Question, do they have the ability to fight it? Right.
I don't think they do. I mean, at the end, everybody's compensation was certainly impacted by what happened with the financial crisis, because while we did better than most, we certainly took our pain. And I think you did find that compensation was significantly reduced following the losses that we took, particularly in 2008.
Although in the middle, before, say, every trader figures out that, gee, the markets really are in turmoil, one can imagine they have a mindset of the past and think that their bonuses depend on doing what they've been doing.
I mean, it's a fair statement, but I think it's it's clear you get paid for performance, and in terms of their resistance, I can't speak to that in terms of how they behave during the crisis, but ultimately. It's the senior management team that determines how people get paid, and I don't know what incentives they may have provided one way or the other, but I can say that people were significantly impacted from a comp perspective just based on the performance of the bank itself.
Really interesting. So maybe from your perspective, as this Mr. Jain is starting to trim, what did you see?
Well, what we saw is the bank, and this is me speaking, by the way, from retrospect, meaning, again, my role of what we were doing with the hedge fund clients, particularly with the hedge fund clients, is we were looking at all of our margining requirements that we had across all of the different products and making sure that we were looking proactively at where prices were going, what was moving to what we would thought was a liquid to more illiquid, and making sure that we were adjusting our margins accordingly. So we run anyways regular stress tests for the hedge fund portfolio. We would run ad hoc stress tests, but we'd also made a number of adjustments over that period of increasing our margin levels as the volatility around asset prices increased and there was more gap risk in the portfolio. So
that's existing business. What about new business? What were you doing on that side?
For new business, we actually saw during the crisis quite a bit of flight to quality. And so we, in our prime brokerage business particularly, as clients were moving away from Bear Lehman, we were onboarding those new clients. The risk department independently assessed the viability, and we tier the clients. And so we would have been doing the same thing that we would normally be doing as far as any clients prior to the crisis. We would assess the hedge fund from a number of different criteria, from their risk management, their liquidity, the leverage they employ, the operational systems they have in place, the independent risk functions, the documentation, and then based on that, we would tier the new clients coming on. So that was happening at the same time, but we were also looking at the margin levels across the different products and making adjustments to those margin levels to make sure that we were adequately covering the gap risk that existed with those products.
And are you, in retrospect, relatively happy with your pricing models, that as you were taking on new business, you were appropriately pricing what turned out to be the risk than before?
Absolutely. The pricing, you could argue that across the whole market, that the return for the risk that you were taking was probably, not probably, certainly in hindsight, was significantly underpriced in terms of and that was across every, I believe, across every business line, not just in the global markets, but you could say in the banking side, and the leveraged finance side, the commercial real estate side. And that was a function of where the market had gone and the fact that a lot of competitors were driving down pricing and returns. And so what we found during the crisis is obviously the risk return was getting back to where it should have gone, and pricing was increasing, and it was easier from a competitive perspective. Some of the competitors were falling away, and I think some of the market, some of the clients recognized that they needed to pay, you know, a fair amount for the risk that was being taken. So you found pricing significantly increasing during the crisis. Now, of course, that changes with, you know, how the market's moving, and you know, we're starting to see the other way now. The pricing pressures are coming back, not to the extent that we're not back to the 2006-2007, but we're starting to see competitive pressures to drive down pricing and competitive pressures to drive down margin levels, for example, for the hedge funds.
Would you mind just picking something that's easier for you to pick and give us a quantitative example of how margins might have changed at some point in time that's easier for you to recollect, just to illustrate the points you're making?
Sure. So I have a team, a quant team, that's responsible for determining what the margin levels are for products. So they would have looked at in the spring of 2007, they would have looked at the RMBS products, the subprime, the Alt-A, and we would have been providing financing to hedge funds in those products. And they would have looked at the volatility around prices and would have, and we did, come out and increase the haircut levels that we had for providing financing on that on those products. I can't say, was it a 50% increase or 100%? I don't have that detail in front of me, but there was a considerable increase in the haircuts that we would apply to the roll of portfolios, you know, that were rolling or new business that would have been coming in at that time.
But it wasn't in the nature of a 20% increase in margin. It was more in the nature of larger multiples than
I would say.
Expected.
I can't tell you exactly the, but it would have been a significant increase, particularly around the more structured credit products. Those are the areas that we focused on first. But we actually, over a 24-month period of time, really starting in the spring of 2007, made a number of adjustments, you know, on a regular basis, looking at all the different products that we were providing financing for, and made sure that we were, you know, adjusting our margin levels, and that was sustainable, and that the business continued to get done, but we made sure that we weren't way off the market, but we wanted to make sure we were protecting the firm. Now, what we found is at the end of 2008, we made our last adjustment in December of 2008. At the very end, starting in 2009, we were hearing significant pressure from the business that we weren't competitive, and so we had to reassess it to say, okay, maybe we had done one tightening too much in terms of the increase in the margin levels. But up to that point in time, it was very it was sustainable, and clients. They made the margin payments, and they weren't balking. There was a period around the convert market in just ahead of Lehman, where there was a lot of volatility around asset prices there, and that was more around getting good prices rather than changing the margin levels. We had increased our margin levels for the convert products already two, 3 months before Lehman. We had started to do that, and in fact increased our margin levels significantly. But right around the time before Lehman, there was a lot more volatility around asset prices in terms of determining what the value of those assets were. So it wasn't around necessarily the margin haircuts, because that had been increased already, but there was a lot of volatility around that.
I'd like to go back to the 2005-2006 time frame. It's really hard sometimes to do effective risk management in a bubble. Can you talk a little about the conversations, processes, and the same kind of issues you're talking about in 1208?
Now, I can, but I can do it in the context of where I was at Barclays Capital.
Oh, that's right.
Now, would that help you or not? Because it's not...
I'd be interested in your insights as if somebody who's sensitive to risk, and then we can talk later about Deutsche Bank and some detail about something else.
There's a lot of common sense of what we do. In the risk function, and you could argue even back in 2005 and 2006, you could see what was happening with the pricing in the market. For example, the commercial real estate market. I had responsibility at Barcab for the American portfolio. And a good signal would have been the gentleman that was brought in to run, set up and run the commercial real estate business came in from Lehman Brothers. And the business model originally was to be structured where 80% of the business was going to be around the CMBS product where you originate, distribute, and sell, and 20% was going to be a repositioning of assets up to 3 to 5 years of providing financing so you could reposition and then either sell the asset or refinance it. And, but what you saw with the competitive dynamics in the marketplace for the CMBS market, as an example, that the competitive dynamics were such the spread levels and the pricing was driven down to the point where it was really hard to make money on packaging the assets and securitizing. So the business model at Barcap changed from a 80% CMBS, 20% from a kind of take and hold repositioning to more like 60-40, 70-30, where they didn't see the ability to really make money by just doing the CMBS. So, I mean, that's a signal in itself that you could say, and we recognize that as well. So, you know, we, as a risk manager, would say, okay, if that's where the market's gone, then you have to be very careful, particularly for the assets now we're putting onto the bank's balance sheet to reposition. And you can be a great have a great nose for real estate, but still, again, from a common sense perspective, you know that you have to make sure that you have adequate structure, adequate cash in the deal to make sure that you're protected. And so that's just one example of in the bubble. There are always signs of the market being, you know, driving down pricing and structure getting looser than what you would like to see.
So it's not your position that this bubble was unprecedented and there was nothing anybody could do?
No, I think, I mean, nobody anticipated what we went through. And there's a lot of lessons learned, you know, in hindsight. And, you know, we were pretty good at Deutsche Bank at connecting the dots and doing, you know, action plans around that. But we certainly didn't connect all the dots, and to be clear. And I think as a risk manager, it's really key to be able to apply common sense, looking at situations, especially when you're in the middle of it, and saying, does it make sense? Does it not make sense? And you know, making sure that you're not doing the marginal transaction.
And Deutsche Bank, unlike Barclays, did not shift to a we will use our balance sheet more intensively.
Well, I wasn't there at the time. Deutsche had a pretty good size commercial real estate business as well. I mean, from a competitive perspective, I believe we're in the top 3 to 5 in the market, in the U.S. market. So, you know, and had that translated in terms of I don't think there was necessarily any shift in the business because the business was already well established. Barclays was establishing a new business. In fact, they started in March of 2004, in fact, right when I joined. So there may have been a different competitive dynamic with Deutsche being an established business already, mm-hmm. and Barclays trying to break into the market and establish itself and get a footprint into it at a time when there were a lot of other competitors. And
did you see any inflection points over the 2000s where the market, and this is before 2007, where the market suddenly changed dynamics? And the bubble accelerated or other things happened, or was this sort of a phenomenon that tracked from about 2001?
I think you really saw a pickup in the businesses in the 2005, 6, and even into the 7 period. And if you just look at historically the revenues that have been generated across the banking market, not just at Deutsche Bank, in areas like securitization, you really saw a significant pickup in that time frame. And I think that around a lot of the structured products, the commercial real estate, all the securitization markets were really, they were building since 2001, but the real ramp up in terms of revenues that were generated for the industry as a whole, from some of the data I've seen, suggests that it was really, you know, 2005, 2006, and into 2007.
we have heard from a number of sources that in that pickup point, covenants started to disappear. Was that your experience? Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I think you saw that particularly in the leverage finance market. You started to see the covenant light transactions start to get done. Some of the these pick toggle notes that were put in place, and this is payment in kind. So effectively, it gave the sponsor the ability to transfer, change the terms to instead of paying cash interest, they could actually accrue it over a longer period. And it was but you clearly saw the pressure in the markets in terms of covenants and structure amortization. The market had moved sometime before that even. Let me take a step back. When I done leverage finance from the business side and done a lot of leverage credit over the years, and many years ago in the late 90s, let's say, not too far ago, you would structure a transaction that would show amortization of the underlying loan over a 5 or 7 year period of time. The market, and I don't know exactly when it moved away from that, but they structured transactions where you pretty much were taking bullet refinancing risk after year 5, and the contractual required amortization was not there. And it used to be where you'd see most of the loan that you were providing. So that's just, that was an indication, but that probably happened prior to 2005. But you clearly saw during the 2005-06 time frame, covenants weaken and structures weaken, leverage levels increase.
At Deutsche Bank, is there any conversation between the risk side and the legal side to talk about risks you see and sort of what kind of covenants protect against those risks?
Well, we certainly interact closely with the legal department, but that is really, you're watching this as a risk manager. You're seeing the transactions come in, and you're able to kind of gauge what's happening in the market. We fortunately, from an underwriting perspective, have been very disciplined. And if you look at our portfolio in terms of performance, historically, I believe Legacy Bankers Trust and Deutsche Bank in the leverage market have had a good track record in terms of the actual defaulting of risk relative to our peers in terms of our underwriting. And I think that did continue through the crisis. What we saw in terms of our own experiences is we didn't lose much money, if any at all, really, on the underwriting that we had in terms of our assets we had on our balance sheet. But rather, where we actually took our pain was in our distribution pipeline. So we, as a large leveraged finance bank in the U.S. market, we had significant level of forward committed transactions that we, in fact, built up with the idea of distributing that risk. And unfortunately, when the market stopped in terms of when the liquidity evaporated very quickly, we were sitting on a pipeline of transactions that normally we would have distributed out into the market, and these were forward-based commitments, and that's where we took our pain in the leveraged finance portfolio. It wasn't on our underwriting. In fact, we did fairly well there, and we continue to do fairly well. We certainly take our losses. It's not like we always get it 100% right, so. But we didn't lose a lot of money on our take and hold portfolio. It was rather on the distribution risks or the pipeline risks that we had.
We've heard that from a number of people in a number of different ways, warehouse lines of credit, various other things. In retrospect, is there a lesson there, or is this something that you've got to assemble a certain minimum amount?
No, there's certainly a lesson there. We actually have made some changes. We've implemented Deutsche. One of the success factors that we've had in terms of our loan portfolio is we initiated a loan exposure management group, a portfolio management team around our loan assets, and we've set. This was the leverage business was outside of the framework, but this was done back after the crisis with WorldCom and Enron, where we very actively hedge out or make sure that we price and hedge out the loan product, particularly for the what we call the investment grade, the higher grade portfolios, where you tend to have larger concentrations because you're having to commit $100 to $300 million to a transaction for a client. And these are the larger U.S. corporates, as an example. And what we learned is based on the last experience, we needed to make sure we eliminated concentration risk. And we were very successful in that area in terms of that part of the book. On the leverage book, the typical take and holds were relatively small, 25, maybe 50 million in that range. And you were secured, so you had other hard assets. So, and the market wasn't as developed in terms of the ability to actually hedge out your exposure. So that market wasn't part of this portfolio management. It now is part of this portfolio management team. In addition, we've implemented market risk limits for our pipeline. So where we really were hurt was we had this large pipeline of to be distributed, and in some cases, forward committed transactions subject to getting the necessary approvals. When liquidity evaporated and market prices increased significantly, that's where we took a lot of pain because the market moved where the pricing on the assets and the commitments we had moved by 300-400 basis points wider. And that's, you can imagine, if you're sitting on a large pipeline, you take quite a bit of pain. And so we've now have put into our pipeline market risk limits to make sure we're hedging out the exposure to pricing volatility.
So does that allow you to assemble pools of the size you need to assemble?
Yeah, we also cut back on the overall aggregate limits that we set for per transaction, per an aggregate, and those limits have been scaled down as well. But yeah, we feel that we have the right now controls in place to be able to facilitate a business today, in fact. From a competitive perspective, I think we're probably still more conservative than some of our competitors around JP, Citi, B of A. They're much larger institutions, and this is their backyard, but I think we have limits in place that, in our view, that are sufficient to allow the business to, you know, continue to operate, but provides us an added protection against these risks that I just mentioned.
I could see business people complaining, I'm going to lose, you know, you give me this landscape of controls and I'm going to lose deals.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
that's what happened.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we've had that come up in terms of from competitive dynamics, particularly now, back... you know, with the market has come back in a big way for the leveraged finance market, and but yeah, we do hear that. That doesn't, for us, we still, you know, we're here to do business, right? If you could say no to every transaction, and you might as well shut down, you know, because that's not. But you need to be smart, and you need to make sure. We've looked at some transactions recently. You know, one transaction, the deal team wanted us to hold a very large $100 million in a covenant light revolver, and we have a policy we don't do that at all. And so, but there was a big IPO, and you get these pressures a lot. But it, for us, look, if it doesn't make sense, and what you come down to, you say, look, if you can hedge it out, and we can show we can hedge it out, and we can get down to a very small hold level, and you have a very high confidence that you're going to get the other business to compensate you for the risk that you're taking, then let's have the discussion, and we'll go through the detail and analyze, you know, in detail. But we pretty much say, look, don't even start, because we're not going to be in a position where we're going to take that large of a hold in a covenant light revolver, as an example.
Again, this may be a question for the global institution, but if I hear you right, the hedging, the protection is done at the business unit level, rather than saying, all right, we'll let you do this deal. Forget about covenant light. I'm too conservative. I always get nervous just hearing the word.
Yeah.
but we're going to let you do the deal, and we're going to hedge it over here someplace in Europe. Or in, I don't know what the right hedge might be. And if it's interest rate risk, that's easier than if it's something else. People don't do that? In other words, it's within the business unit that the hedge will be designed?
No, so actually, the example I mentioned, this, the portfolio team that hedges, they actually sit within the business, But they have a dotted line into risk, and risk sets the thresholds. So independent of the business, depending on the rating, we set thresholds of how much unsecured risk that we're willing to take. And it kind of, it's a benchmark. So each case is looked at and analyzed in terms of the ability to distribute the risk, the ability to actually hedge the risk. And is it
a global?
It's a global.
So you'll allocate that number down to the business units as they need it.
Well, it's by counterparty. So it's by, you know, how much risk, and this is for the specifically the larger type of counterparties. But even it goes all the way down to even single B. It says if you have a single B, and if it's in a developed market versus an emerging market, the thresholds, and if it's so there's a whole grid that gets set independent of the business that risk sets. As the kind of broad parameters of what we're willing to do, then in terms of the actual hedging itself, the hedging they're required to hedge the risk numbers within those limits that get established, and those are looked at on a regular basis to see whether they need to be adjusted. But they're done independent of the business. It's the risk function that actually does the review of that. And
we're going to have to ask about that, but I'm interested in another question first. I'm interested in the structure eventually, and you alluded to that, the structure of the risk function versus vis-a-vis the business units and communications and all that. But first, you mentioned early that one of your jobs on the business side when you're doing the hedge funds was capital allocation, if I heard right.
When I was on the risk side, capital allocation only to the extent of not on a macro capital allocation, but rather the team was responsible for setting the risk appetite for that particular counterparty.
So it's all because you're on the credit side. You constantly think about counterparties. I'm trying to get at an issue of capital allocation
from the business side.
From the business side, sort of again. Down from the top and
right.
How that process works.
Well, we have a capital plan that gets updated on a yearly basis, and each of the businesses are allocated they have their own capital for that particular business, and there may be growth built into it. There may be contraction depending on where the business is and what we want to do. But so the businesses, the capital plan gets, we've got a committee that looks after the capital plan. So it's a forward-looking plan, but it's updated on an annual basis. I believe it goes out over 5 years, and it looks at what we need to maintain for our capital overall as the bank as a whole, what's happening in the market in terms of capital, so of course you have to take that into account, the changes that you anticipate may have. And then you look at the expected growth. What are the demands for capital for the year? What do you expect to earn during the year to help grow your business? And also, where is the growth going to be in which business? And that gets allocated to each of the business in terms of for the year.
So it spills down.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of a combined top down bottom up type plan. The guys will plan what they think their growth
last
will be.
And then some committee will resolve it and give the final allocation.
That's right. Ultimately, the board will sign off on that for the businesses.
So as you head into an unusual 2007, do those numbers change?
I can't speak to that. I've been involved in the capital plan since I rejoined in January 2007. And I can't speak whether or not I don't think they probably did change. I would have what you saw clearly in retrospect is the across the board is there was certainly a significant increase in the banking sector in terms of leverage and balance sheet, and Deutsche was no exception. I mean, our balance sheet grew during as the rest of the market was growing and as our business was growing. What I can tell you is. Part of this de-risking that we started in the spring of 2007 and continuing all the way to today, much, much more disciplined on balance sheet and we've reduced our balance sheet in our global markets business, for example, by over 40% over the last since the spring of 2007. We've also done a complete de-risking of our prop trading. That's down by over 90%. We've reduced our level three assets down significantly. So we've been in a mode over the last 2 years to reduce balance sheet, reduce legacy assets, reduce our illiquid positions, and at the same time, we've seen a significant pickup. Even though we reduced our prop trading, we've seen a significant pickup on our what we call our client flow business. Part of that was a flight to quality, some less competitors and people coming to Deutsche Bank. Quite a bit of it was clients repositioning their own positions and having to put on hedging either through the FX markets or through the rates market. So we saw a significant pickup in our client business all the way up through the first quarter of this year. And so for 2009 and for the first quarter of 2010, that fell off in the second quarter with the sovereign crisis in Europe and people becoming much more risk averse. And we saw, like everybody did across the market, a reduction in our client flow business in the second quarter of this year. But we've taken a lot of action to de-risk our balance sheet, reduce the balance sheet, particularly in our global markets area.
Did you guys ever sell CDS protection?
Did we ever sell CDS? Oh, yeah, sure.
So you offered protection. You were selling...
We were a big seller of CDS, yes.
So how did you manage it, and what kind of capital would you allocate to CDS?
I can't tell you what kind of the capital that you, the CDS that we sold would have been in a lot of different products, I'm sure. It would have been on indexes, on single names, it would have been across the board. I mean, Deutsche Bank is a very large derivatives house and was a very large seller of CDS in the market, very active, and we would be an active counterparty with most of all the top banks. We'd be a very active counterparty with the hedge fund space, with a lot of the real money fund clients. And in terms of how do we price that and the capital, I mean, I think it depends on the exposure, the counterparty that you're talking about. The hedge funds have certain initial margin requirements, and the banks operate a little bit differently. You have typically a very small threshold, unsecured threshold, and your daily margining back and forth in those positions.
I need to understand it better, if I may.
Sure.
We had a public hearing of a very large company that had a huge amount of CDS protection they sold, didn't allocate any capital to it, and I'm just curious how one runs that business in a more prudent manner.
Right. Well, I think you have to look at your book and how well balanced your book is in terms of, you know, you may have a large...
So you'd be selling CDS on one side and buying it on the other?
Right. We acted as an intermediary for the most part. We don't like to have unhedged positions. We'd like to... So we could be selling a hedge fund CDS, and we could be buying the same CDS from J.P. Morgan, as an example, and hedging off the exposure.
Which gets to your counterparty risk issue.
Yeah, that's right. And you set limits also for how much risk that you have uncovered. I mean, what we really want to make sure is that we're, to a large extent, acting as an intermediary, and we're hedged. Now, it's not to say you're always hedged, because sometimes if you have a prop book, you may have someone has a view and they've sold protection or bought protection because they think it's going to appreciate, you know. But that business, as I mentioned, we've significantly reduced. But for the most part, when we're looking at our portfolios, we want to make sure that we're balanced and that we're not, you know, overly exposed in one direction or the other.
Now, will that be done again within the business unit or at the enterprise-wide unit?
It's both, because the limits that get set will get set independently at the enterprise-wide risk area. So they'll set limits for the trading desk of how much exposure that they can have, P&L exposure that they would have, and VAR limits get set by product, by desk. And then the business itself, they're expected to be managing the risk within their portfolios, and each of the areas have, for example, in the global markets area, the different product lines have their own risk managers to look after, particularly counterparty risk on a proactive basis. but they also they have risk managers to make sure that the positions that they have on are that they're balanced and that they're thought through and that they're not, you know, they're not too concentrated in this.
So these are the embedded risk officers within the business unit.
Yes, they're part of the business, and they're there to make sure that they're managing the exposures within the business itself. Now, they don't have any independent authority to set the limits.
They work for the business unit.
Exactly right.
So interesting. So maybe we should go to that question of the structure of the risk function from the enterprise on down, if that were possible.
Sure. So we have a chief risk officer who also is responsible for legal compliance, treasury, and what we call business continuity and corporate security. And he reports into the board.
Market risk
too. I'm sorry. And he reports up into the board. He is a board member, in fact. He sits on our executive board. And he reports regularly to the supervisory board, which is the outside board of directors, effectively. And there's a risk committee within the supervisory board. He regularly...
I need to understand that. That's a peculiar European structure.
Yeah.
Maybe can you run that by again? Sorry.
So we have a management board.
Two boards.
Yeah, there's a management board which is made up of 8 individuals, CEO Dr. Ackerman, and then Anshu Jain sits on that, who runs global markets. He now runs all of investment banking. There was another gentleman who was retiring, Michael Kors, an American who ran our banking. But with his retirement, Anshu Jain will take all those businesses. And then you have... head of our operations sits on the board level, Mr. Lamberti. You have head of our PBC, our private and business client business, Rainier Nevsky, sits on the board. Head of all of our regional management, Jürgen Fitchen. So they have 8 individuals sitting at the management board.
Mm-hmm.
Separate from that is the supervisory board, which is, I guess, equivalent to the outside board of directors.
Okay, and that is your board of directors. You don't have a board of directors above that.
No, the supervisory board would be the board of directors. So there's the management board, and it represents all the Deutsche employees, part of the senior management team. And then the board, effectively the supervisory board is the outside, and there's nobody that sits on the supervisory board that is a member of the management.
Including the CEO.
Including the CEO. There's a head of the supervisory board, Mr. Borsig, who... Dr. Ackerman will report into for the purposes of reporting up into the board. He runs the supervisory board, and then there's individuals that are all outside of the bank itself.
And does your supervisory board have roughly the board of directors function?
Yes, that's exactly right, I would say. I mean, yeah.
Do they have a risk committee? And
they do have a risk committee, and there's individuals on the board, the supervisory board, that make up that risk committee. And there's regular reporting to that committee and to the broader supervisory board, but to that committee, I believe at least quarterly reporting on the risk profile of the bank and updates regularly.
I don't know how to ask this elegantly, so I'll ask it inelegantly, since we're going to go from the top of the organization on down.
Okay.
It's hard for a part-time board to understand technical issues, what are the limits of VAR? I mean, choose your issue. Is this stress test the right one? What is the quality of value added of a risk committee on this supervisory board to the way risk is actually managed at the company?
It's a very fair question. I cannot address that because I personally have not had interaction with the individuals, but I do know the chief credit officer, for example, Stuart Lewis, has had interaction with the outside supervisory board, and I think his feeling is actually they're pretty clued in, and they ask very good questions. But I think part of the requirement of the bank itself and the risk management function is to make sure you're communicating the issues to that board in a manner that they do understand. And in fact, the mantra that we have within the risk organization under Hugo Banzinger is to make sure that you're providing a clear message, and any presentation that you're doing at any level for him, I mean, it's ingrained in our DNA that you have to be able to provide input in a way that's understandable, I mean, clearly understandable to a layperson that didn't, you know. And there's regular reporting that I know that he provides up, and we get involved in helping put together the presentations. And the decks that get put together are very extensive. And but to your question, I can't address whether the individuals, you're absolutely correct, but I can't say whether or not they've got the grasp of the most sophisticated products that the banking world has created over the last several years. It's hard for me to say.
3 months, which is worse. Okay, so we're a supervisory board,
right,
and the management board, and the risk officer is part of that, Mr.
Yeah.
Banzinger.
Yeah, so he sits on the board itself, independent, and the culture, well, I won't talk about the culture, but I can tell you he has a significant voice on the board from the risk function. He is a peer with his other business board members, Andre Jane, for example, and then below Hugo, he has regular, he's a head of credit risk, head of market risk, head of treasury, head of operational risk.
Not liquidity, that's done.
No, he's in charge of treasury, yes. The treasury is responsible for our liquidity management. He has regular weekly meetings that he meets with this team to get updated on what's going on in the market. He has regular meetings that he has a broader team of risk managers participate in. It's usually every couple months in person, quite often, to go over issues around risk. Also underneath each of those different disciplines, each of those have their own executive committees. So credit will have their credit risk management executive committee. Market risk will have their senior management committees. Treasury is the same. And they meet regularly as well. They all have, you know, so you have kind of, I'm going from the top down, but what you have is you have each of those areas that have their own executive committees, regular meetings, minuted meetings. Everything is very very documented, and they all, by the way, flow up. All those individual executive meeting minutes go up to Hugo Banzinger as the chief risk officer. So he gets an opportunity to review what's being discussed at each of the, you know, in addition to the regular meetings that he has weekly with his direct reports, he also looks at the discussion points at each of the different the risk areas.
What about in a crunch? There are two bear funds that are suddenly starting to look shaky.
Yep.
How long does it take that information to get to the various levels?
Well, since I'm the individual that was responsible, I can tell you, I provided daily emails to Hugo Banzinger, and I was on the phone with him several times.
So you would send up a flag instantly saying,
oh,
we better watch this.
Oh, absolutely. To within the risk organization, absolutely.
And then would a message come down, you know, tell me the implications of this, or how would they start to figure out, gee, is this a parochial issue or is this linked to other things?
Well, that's one of the things that I think we do very well at Deutsche, in that you're expected to not just look at one incident and say, okay, this is what's happening right here. The expectation is you have to be thinking always this way in terms of knock-on impacts. And so
you, the credit officer, risk officer, or also the business people?
Well, right now I'm speaking about the risk function.
Okay.
On the risk function, we have regular global calls, in fact, weekly calls on the credit risk side. Every Wednesday morning, 6 a.m. New York time, is a global call. And in that call, the point of it is to talk about issues that are happening around the world so that people are aware of, okay, we've got an event happening in this market. Is there a knock-on impact potentially to my own portfolio? And the expectation is that you're thinking about your portfolio in the broadest sense possible. But if we have a specific example, you have the Bear Stearns hedge funds. When I was reporting up, you know, daily, at the end of the day, I would provide a summary of the events of the day. We put together these risk notes when there's an occurrence happening, and one of the things that we have to comment on is not only the situation at hand, and you know, what does it mean for our risk? What does it mean, action plan that we're taking? But then there's a commentary that you know, what other impacts to the portfolio, you know, knock-on impacts this may have. So you're really expected to be thinking, in many directions, not just the one incident that's at hand.
And presumably Mr. Benzinger at that point starts to ask his questions.
Yeah,
others in the organization.
Oh, yeah. But one of the things that we do very well, and it's really said from the top, is there's great communication across all the risk functions. So we talk to the legal department. We're all part of the same division, and we meet regularly anyways, and there's a great kind of informal relationship that we've established, but you're expected, again, to think about, okay, what does this mean for the broader organization? Does it have a knock-on impact from a legal perspective? Are the market risk implications of this? And there's a cohesiveness in terms of the dialogue.
Just out of curiosity, slight digression, when you saw Covenant Lights starting to flow across your desk, would you call legal and say, what does this thing mean? Or, I mean, would there be a conversation on that?
With legal and Covenant Lights, I can't speak specifically because I was covering the hedge funds and FIs.
Yeah.
But I do know that the leverage team sits just, you know, down the hall from me, and I think that they're pretty smart guys. They're very seasoned guys. They've been around for a lot of years, and they've been doing leveraged finance for a number of years. So they probably wouldn't have called legal and say, well, you know, what does this mean? Because they know what it means. They probably would be talking to legal. Legal is involved in terms of reviewing the documentation, making sure that, you know, that things work. And so they probably would have had discussions around it. You know, you see this, you know, I don't like this. Maybe we should push back on that and try to get something else, you know, in replace of that.
So your part, going back to the structure, just to make sure that my digressions fit
this
totally away. Say within the credit function, there are the subsidiary groups, and you are part of a group that will report to the chief credit person who reports to Mr. Benzinger.
Yeah, now in my new role as the chief risk officer for the Americas, it's a bit it's the only place that we have a chief risk officer. And it's a new role.
We earned the distinction.
We have a global function around credit, market risk, treasury, and regional people that have reported up, and they still do. But now in my new role, the regional heads for the Americas report also into me. So they have a line into me, and they have a line into their global head. But in my previous role, I would have reported into the chief credit officer for the bank.
And again, I just got nervous when I heard in the minutes are sent up and so on. That sounded like a very static function. It's also had some fluidity to it when you were reporting up to the chief credit officer.
When you say a static function?
We're meeting every month and we're sending our minutes up the line.
No, it's a very dynamic function itself. I just use that as an example of these minutes. That get taken are something that even at the very top of the house, Hugo Banzinger, he'll review them. But he also has his direct reports meeting. The chief credit officer meets with him weekly. So I guess I'm trying to communicate that there's really a very cohesive across all the different risk functions and communication, and it's kind of been instilled from the very top. And then one of that communications functions is the formal minutes that get taken of the discussions around the critical issues that are facing credit, market risk. But that's just one of many different ways that we communicate.
So then as we go down, you're describing a risk function. If I heard right, you have business units. They will have embedded people that may have understand risk, but those are business people, not risk people.
That's correct.
What are the relationships in these two parallel silos?
So the relationship is, there's quite a bit of interaction between the independent risk function and the risk managers within the business. If a transaction comes up that we're looking at to approve large counterparty exposure, there'll be a conversation within the business itself. Global markets is the trading business, as an example. There's a very senior individual who reports directly into the guy running the business, who is the broad risk manager, among other things. He's also the balance sheet guy who looks after the balance sheet, but he very senior guy, and we from the independent risk function would go and say, hey, we're looking at this transaction. We've got some concerns about the size or the structure. Are you aware of it? Just to get it on their radar to make sure that the business guy within the business is, you know, looking at it. So that would be like an interaction, or there may be concern about our overall exposure to the counterparty, and this is an incremental trade that we're not, so we'll talk about, those types of issues. They'll independently look at these, and he's, again, at a very high level. Then within each of the product areas, they have risk managers that look after, for example, the counterparty exposures, derivative exposures that they have to particular counterparties, and they'll be actively managing that portfolio within the limits that get set to them. They could go in and
get set to them by the risk function?
By the risk function. So the risk function is completely independent of the business. The risk function sets the risk appetite, the limits for a counterparty, as an example. The risk manager within that that business line he's managing a whole portfolio of counterparty exposures, and he's got to stay within his limits, but he may have a different view. He may say, you know what, I'm going to take a different view on a particular counterparty, and I'm going to hedge more. He can't go above his limits, but he can certainly, if he wants to, from a risk management perspective, he may have a view of a certain sector, and I'm just using that as an example, and say, okay, I think we need to shorten our counterparty exposure to the autos, as an example. Mm-hmm. And he can go out and hedge out that exposure.
And if you, on the risk side, suddenly say, gee, it's time to ratchet our limits down, and assume a line of business is very unhappy about that, how does the conversation go?
Well, we've had to do that, and the conversation goes usually, oh, you're going to kill my relationship. But it again, the risk function is completely independent, and so if we have a particular counterparty that we're concerned with, or we will cut back on, or we will require higher hedging, for example, we could go. But now the sensitivity that you have, of course, is that these guys are in the business, and we're outside of the business. Now, 98% of the time, we're making decisions based on our view of what's out in the public domain in terms of information on a sector. There's a very, very few occasions that you have to be a little sensitive to directing them to take down positions if you're got information that is sensitive, right? So you can't just say, the client calls you up and says, oh, we're about to file bankruptcy. Well, that's an extreme, but they never would do that, by the way. They don't call you up. You read about it usually, right? Unfortunately. But as an example, you couldn't take that information and then direct the guys to cut all your limits, right? So that's an extreme situation. I would say we have regular discussions. We review all of our counterparties at least annually, part of the normal counterparty review process. And can adjust our limits based on that review. But in addition to that, we do what we call our industry batches. Every counterparty exposure that we have falls within an industry batch. So it could be a hedge fund portfolio, it could be a real money portfolio, it could be insurance company portfolio, it could be a bank portfolio, it could be a transportation portfolio. There's many different industry batches, and we review every one of those once a year. And in these reviews, it looks at the key drivers for the sector as a whole. It looks at the portfolio. It looks at whether or not we should be adding risk or taking risk in aggregate into that particular sector, depending on our view. They're very extensive documents, and the credit department does this. And with that, you could make an adjustment to your risk appetite, and say for this sector, we need to be reducing our exposure, and then you work closely with the business, and you work on getting those reductions made.
I'm a business officer head, and I think autos are coming back big time, and you're cutting back on my limits. What's my recourse?
For the sector as a whole?
Well, I'm trying to figure out what happens.
How did this disagreement get resolved if the business disagrees? Oh,
okay, so let's say on a transaction, there's a transaction. It comes up through my team, and we decline the transaction. There is an appeal process, but it's within the independent risk function. So there's no independent business person that can say, well, we're going to overrule what the credit guy said. So if I turn down a transaction, then the next appeal process would be to the chief credit officer for the bank. And they can appeal my decision. But again, it's an independent appeal process. And
then, the appeal is within the risk function.
That's right.
Mostly business, so.
Right. And then ultimately, it can go to the board level if it has to. But very rare does it ever go to the board level. Because I think it's understood that if it's been declined and it's been appealed and declined, then it doesn't make sense. You know, the deal is usually, the business kind of gets the fact that, okay, this is done.
I talked to one former chief risk officer who said, if you're a risk officer, you've always got to be ready to walk the plank. And we had several other interviews with risk officers who at some point said, either I'm going to become a pain in the neck of the chief of the organization and have to constantly say no, or else I'm going to be the chief risk officer at a place that blew itself up, I'm resigning. It doesn't sound like that's the set of issues you face here at Deutsche Bank.
No, I think it really starts from the top and with Hugo Banzinger in terms of his influence in the organization, you know, what's instilled in the culture from a risk perspective. So the business guys, I think they get it. The senior business guys absolutely get it. Where you get into issues is like you may have one guy way down in the organization that may have a client relationship that's the most important thing in the world to him. But I think if it's a newcomer, for example, and they come in, they learn pretty quickly. The risk function is very strong at Deutsche. It's very independent. I think we're commercial. You have to be commercial, just to be clear. You have to be, you know, I think we're pretty smart. It's not a rubber stamp by any stretch at all. I mean, we're there to, if anything, we may say, hey, look, you need to change the structure. You need to reduce the level of risk that we're going to hold. We try to be proactive in terms of, you know, helping get things done. But if it doesn't make sense, you know, that's why we get paid, is to make sure that we're protecting shareholders and making sure that we're making smart decisions and we're not, you know, doing stupid things. Now, it's not to say we'll always get it right. As far as the decisions, you know, we certainly have made some bad decisions, but for the most part, the starts from the top, and I think people recognize that, you know. So I personally, do I have confrontations with the business? Absolutely. Is it a relationship where I feel like this unbearable pressure that, oh, I have to go along because, you know, no. In fact, if anything, there's a respect there that comes from the business side to the risk functions, and they believe, particularly at a very senior level, absolutely, and that kind of gets filtered down. You know, there's the occasional where somebody will holler and scream and, you know, I'm going to, who's your boss, you know? but from a overall perspective, I don't think that there's this pressure where you feel like, you know, you got to walk the plank.
As a career pattern, do you have people shifting from the business side to the risk side and back?
We have, yes, we do. What we see is at the senior level, most of the senior risk managers have come from the business at some point. I mean, my background, I spent a lot of my early part of my career when the old banking model where you did risk and marketing in the same capacity, and then there was a very small group of senior decision makers that would sign off on all the credit work that you did as the guy, the relationship officer, as an example. That model changed probably in the early 90s in the U.S. where you had a separate risk function from the marketing function and then the structuring function. I'm sorry, your question.
Do people rotate back?
Oh yes, yes, yes. So what
pattern?
So the senior people have spent most of the senior people. If I just look at the credit area as an example. Have spent time in the business itself and have been in a risk function and are now risk managers. And they're not looking to move back into the business per se, although we've had a couple of senior people who have moved from a senior credit role into the portfolio management team, as an example. What we see at the junior level is we have analysts that come into the bank, go through the credit training program that we have. They rotate around into different areas, and then, you know, typically 3 years after they've gotten through the program, they'll move into the business. Now, it's not designed by us to say they have to do that. There's some analysts that don't want to be part of the business. They don't want to have that pressure, but there's others that we will, you know, so you see movement more from our area into the business. Now, we encourage that because we want to get our own people out in there and get the kind of the credit risk culture broader in, within the business. We know these guys, too. We know that they've been trained, and they kind of get it when they go out there. So we also, it gives us an opportunity to attract really good talent to bring people in, really smart people, and say, look, your opportunities are you come in, you work, you get a broad experience, you see more banking than you would otherwise if you just specialized in one area. And then after several years of, you know, we're going to make a commitment to you, we're going to spend quite a bit of money training you, our program's pretty extensive as far as rotation, and then we're going to need to get something paid back by our commitment to you, but then you have an opportunity to move into the business. So we do see that as well.
And is there a differential in compensation between the business types and somebody of equivalent seniority in the risk side?
I would say I'm sure there is a differential of people in different parts of the business, the front versus what we would call, you know, the infrastructure, the risk function. The disparity, I can't tell you. I think that at a senior level within the risk organization at Deutsche, you're never paid enough. For the record. No, but I think we get paid. We get paid well in terms of the senior level, and I think that's part of also Hugo Banzinger wants to attract the best talent, and he knows he has to do that by getting, you know, the best people possible. Is it on par with the business? I really can't comment. I would suspect that depending on the business line and depending on the individual, it's probably not always equal. But I think there is an emphasis to make sure that people get paid. Particularly at a senior level within the risk function.
Within the, there's one risk we haven't talked about that has beset a number of firms, and that's reputational risk. Who's responsible for that?
We have a we have a regional committee process for reputational risk. So this broader reputational risk group, but there's in the Americas there's a committee process. And in that, you have the head of compliance for the U.S., the head of legal, our general counsel for the U.S., our corporate secretary, our COO for the region, and then myself recently, my new role was put onto that committee. So there's five of us that represent the reputational risk committee. So transactions will get brought through different areas of the firm. It doesn't. It's not just five individuals. They actually represent the committee itself. But things will get raised by the legal department, by the compliance department, by the credit officers about anything that they feel needs to be reviewed from a reputational perspective.
I don't want to be too stylized about this, but assume you had a transaction where somebody was going short, was picking the collateral for the CDO, and somebody else was unhappy about that. Who bought this thing? Would that ever get surfaced to a reputational risk committee, or is that too arcane and it's going to catch people automatically by surprise?
I can't answer that. I think your reputational committee is only as good as the individuals, people raising the issues, and so the committee may not even know that it existed. For example, so the likelihood is that. You need to have somebody individual
who's independent
is thinking about, but also just to that point, the independent risk function itself, the market risk officers, the credit risk officers, the the legal department are expected that if something comes up that the mantra is that if you read about it in the front page of the Wall Street Journal, how would you feel about it? Or, you know, we have a franchise that's more important to us than any one transaction. You know, we have to make sure that people think that way. And it's in our training as well. Again, it's a broad training for people around the reputational issues. But on that specific case, I couldn't tell you. I don't think the committee itself is necessarily going to know that that's happening unless somebody has flagged it to say, hey, I think you need to take a look at this.
Right. That's in the credit area, to what extent, I mean, this is a leading question and there's a clear answer, but I'd be interested, I don't know how to ask it subtly, so I'll
okay.
Ask it straight. To what extent do you rely on AAA ratings on structured products?
We have a completely independent rating process from a counterparty perspective. So the ratings that the rating agencies provide, and I'm going to step outside of structured credit for a second, maybe not answer your question. I'm not trying to avoid it, but just to give you a perspective of, you know, we have, for every counterparty we have an independent rating process. It follows a similar grid as the rating agencies do. We have our own rating sheets, so when we analyze the counterparty, we go through and we score them and put them in different categories around, you know, leverage and liquidity and management and operational and competitiveness. But we will look at where our ratings are relative to where the public ratings, if there are public ratings, as an example. And we'll look at other indicators like where the CDS spreads are to see, okay, how does the CDS look relative to, you know, so there's a number of variety of things that we look at from a our own assessment of a particular counterparty. Now, getting back to, did we rely on the rating agencies for their ratings of AAA securities? I think everybody had, we didn't have an over-reliance per se, but we certainly took our pain in the structured credit areas, and where we probably missed it most was not necessarily relying on the rating agencies per se of their AAA ratings. Is, you know, the areas that we actually look to de-risk our exposures were done with very highly rated entities, i.e. the monolines at the time, and the likes of AIG and other insurance companies. So we certainly would have said, okay, here's a AAA security, and let's hedge out that exposure. And where we didn't connect the dots very well was, again, not dependent on the ratings per se, but on the direct correlation between the decline in the value of the AAA securities and the ability of the counterparty that you've hedged that exposure to be able to, exactly. And we missed that. Not your question, but, you know, from a model perspective and exposure.
Model risk.
Yeah, I mean, that was another lesson that we clearly had learned is that, you know, we like all banks, use models to calculate our exposures and what we thought would be the potential exposure on a transaction, let's say. And we certainly, you know, our models looked at historic information, but we certainly learned our lessons in that regard as well in terms of, you know, looking at exposure solely in a model base, and the tail risk was much greater than we all expected in terms of in a lot of areas. So we had exposures where we thought the exposures through our expected exposure calculation that were significantly higher than we expected when we executed the trade at the beginning.
But you guys at least weren't blindly relying on VAR. You knew, understood what that tail, that there was something there.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I don't think anybody expected the level of tail risk that we had. But
I want to make sure I understood all that you said, which covered a lot. So forgive me.
That's okay.
for retracing. But first, you said for corporate credit, you have your own analysis and your own internal rating.
Yeah, for all.
For all
of the counterparty exposures that we would take, where the bank is committing their capital, they would have a independent rating. Yeah.
But for structured products, because presumably because the universe is so large, I didn't hear you say.
We do now, and we did then, but we do because of Basel II purposes. We have to have an independent rating for all of our securitization transactions. I mean, we've always had an independent rating, but it has to fall within a very detailed, approved by our regulators, the BaFin, and
rating. So you did have your own rating risk assessment for structured products?
I think we did have an independent function that was involved in transactions in which we were putting the bank's capital, you know, either through lending to a conduit, for example, where there were structured credits in it. We would have gone through an independent process for the approval, independent review of that. Now, they may or may not have had a public rating, but, for example, if somebody on the trading desk bought a AAA CMBS paper, that would fall... that would not be rated by the independent credit and functioning, because it would be part of our trading positions, and they're set. They set their limits in terms of what they could have based on the rating, as an example. So where we have our capital at risk and we have a counterparty exposure, there's a total independent rating function. So if in the case of a we were providing liquidity support to a conduit that was buying CMBS, we would that independent credit team would be looking at the portfolio and assessing it. They may or may not, I can't speak because, again, I wasn't there. They may or may not be looking at the public rating to say, okay, this is a AAA CMBS tranche, and it's got this amount of subordination underneath it, and it represents, from a diversity perspective, 2% of the portfolio. They would be looking at those things. But if there was a AAA CMBS security that was in the trading book, the trader would have bought that, and his limits would have been set based on the rating of the counterparty.
On your determination of the ratings?
No. That would have been determined by the public ratings the limits that got set, and still get to set to some extent, of what they can put on. They have aggregate limits and so forth, but they can put on they can buy a security into the firm that is a public security that is rated. And depending on the rating, that would determine the overall size of exposure.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, did you, within whatever line of analysis, have models that related to the subprime market, that were related to, well, what happens if housing prices go down by 10% or 30% or stay flat, and did you then apply those models in any way to looking at the monolines liabilities?
Yeah, I would say no. What we did is we did have stress testing that we do, but just to give you an example of the modeling, you know, where the models went. I can give you one credit example. ACA was a monoline that was, I think it, at the best of times, was an A-minus rated monoline, and the business came to us and was aggressively pursuing wanting to do business with ACA. And the risk appetite that my team had, to their credit, was, no, we don't want more than $10 million of exposure to ACA completely, because they're a second or third tier monoline. And so we ended up doing a couple of trades. One trade they took off because it was in the money for them. They had an interest to do that. But we had one trade on only, and this is despite the business really trying to push to do more business, and we said, no, our risk appetite, we're at that level. And the one trade at the time that the trade was executed had a potential exposure under our model of $8 million. And it was a AAA tranche of a RMBS subprime that was $100 million notional. Within 18 months, that security lost $98 million. So again, my point is, on the modeling perspective, you know, we had models in place. Did we run stress tests? We do run stress tests on the portfolio. Did we run a case of the housing market drops 10% or 20%? I don't think we did. I don't believe we did do that. But we certainly learned our lesson in terms of the reliance on models. And we also have been rolled out a much broader stress testing methodology for the bank as well as a result of the crisis.
The ACA example you gave is, again, based on a corporate credit analysis rather than on focusing on your own view of structured credit.
Well, it was a structured credit. I mean, it was a CDS that we had bought from ACA.
But I thought I heard that the resistance to the business was because you didn't trust ACA's credit.
Yeah, we thought, well, yeah, that's right. We thought that we didn't want to take more than $10 million in exposure. So yes, we from a counterparty perspective, we didn't think that they were an entity that could handle more than that in terms of risk, in our view. Now, that was ahead of the whole market and before ACA hit the wall, and, you know, I think some of our competitors had significantly higher exposures to ACA. That's just one example. We've had our share of other where we weren't as fortunate as that.
Brad has suggested we might take a break. I have only about three more areas. You've been wonderful in terms of answers, and we really appreciate it.
Sure.
So if we were to take a short break and then come back to wrap up, does that work?
That's great.
And I have about 15 minutes or so.
Okay, whatever you guys, I'm here for you. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure. The restroom?
Back on record.
Hey, thank you. And Kim will be in a minute. I'll ask about a couple of things. I'd really love to learn if there were a way you guys could send us an email later or something, sort of where this culture came from, where the risk sensitivity, the discipline, whatever came from. I don't know if it came from your predecessor organization in the States, but it's very interesting, and to some extent, it's the hallmark of an institution that can fare better than others in this kind of crisis.
I think Hugo Banzinger joined Deutsche, I want to say, the mid-90s, 96 or so, and he became, shortly within a year or two of him joining, he became the chief credit officer for the bank. And then over the years, he took on a bigger role, and then, you know, the chief risk officer and among the other areas. So he really brought the thinking around how originally the credit organization was structured, and that discipline and that, you know, way to think and that independent strong independent view and also respect, I think, from the business side, and then he just continued that on through the market risk area when he took on that, the treasury area. So I would say it's really evolved since the mid-90s.
And Dr. Ackerman brought him on?
He did. No, actually, I think Edison Mitchell brought him on. Edison Mitchell was former senior executive running our investment bank, and he came in from Merrill Lynch and hired Hugo, I believe. But in terms of how it's evolved, it's really, I think it starts really with a strong personality, and Hugo is a strong personality, and clearly a brilliant guy. Has done many things for the organization, for the risk organization, and then the broader now what we call legal risk and capital. Charlie's got the benefit of coming in from the legal department a couple of years ago, but he rolled out a number of things from a culture, from a communication, from a training perspective, from, you know, that he's instilled in the culture that we have, that we've kind of, it's ingrained in the credit organization and now in the broader kind of legal risk and capital.
And somehow the CEOs, plural, were supportive of that.
I think Dr. Ackerman, the CEO, who's been the CEO, we've had a very consistent management team for a number of years at a very senior level. So if you look back, we haven't had a lot of turmoil. So it really starts at the board level, the management board level. And so clearly, Hugo and Dr. Ackerman have a very strong relationship. He looks, you know, I'm sure they talk daily or depending on what's happening in the markets on issues. And I think that there's a lot of respect, and that, you know, from a risk perspective, the independence has, I think, always been there. But with Hugo, he clearly, the respect of the business is certainly there. And I think if you look at Anshu Jain as another example, he... maybe it's through his upbringing and what he experienced, I'm sure it is, but he's been around for a number of years, and he's been running that business for a number of years, the global markets business, and what instilled him, his own risk thinking in terms of, you know, looking at the business and going through the de-risking, I can't, I would assume it's his past experience, but But there is undoubtedly within the senior levels of the firm a real risk awareness, and again, the culture is to the business is expected to be the first risk managers. They're expected to be the ones selecting the clients, looking at the products, and that mindset is clearly there, and that's reminded to them on a regular basis that look, you are our first line of defense. But again, the risk function has been independent for many years.
It would be helpful to understand, and I don't quite know how we can do this, how traders and others are compensated to promote going along with that kind of risk awareness, that I'm willing to live with a limit, I'm willing to stay in an organization that imposes limits without giving me, if I heard right, a lot of recourse up the line, versus going someplace else. I'd be just curious, because compensation seems to have driven so many decisions.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I can tell you that despite the fact that we've done better than most, we certainly had our issues, right? So we weren't perfect. We had lots of things that we learned. And one of the things that we're working on right now is how do you broaden that risk culture in the business line itself, and how do you make sure that it's all the way through at the very senior level, certainly there, but how do you get it from the entry level of people coming into the organization, and how do you make sure that it's part of like the DNA of their thinking? So we're looking at things of making sure that risk specifically and risk awareness is part of their performance management objectives, and this is all evolving from the crisis to make sure that we, even though we've done pretty well, we're certainly looking to make sure that risk culture at the business level permeates not just at the top and not, you know, the people who do the risk management but independently for the business and the guys running the businesses, and it's not just the extreme top, it's you know, a number of layers, and there are individuals, but what we're really working on is making sure that it gets, as newcomers come into the organization, as people come, you know, out of grad school into the business for the first time, how do you broaden that risk culture for the business itself?
It's not your area, but liquidity risk management. I'd be curious. I mean, you had a very interesting write-up on the web. I will tell you that there's a certain well-known European institution that had a superb write-up on the web in 2006, and then in 2008 had a report to shareholders on how it was formality rather than reality.
I read that. That's probably why I used to work there, I think.
Okay, yes, you did, actually.
I read that 55 pages. Very insightful.
Yeah,
actually, from a liquidity management, I would say if you look at Deutsche and the crisis, that's probably one of the areas that we shined and outshined most. In 2007, were very proactive in terms of our liquidity management, and back in the summer of 2007, went to the market and termed out quite a bit of our short-term funding. And we issued, in fact, we issued at levels where there was a lot of scrutiny, even internally, because of the levels that in the summer of 2007 that we actually went to issue in the market, you know, were at levels that were significantly higher than we had been issuing at, and people were challenging, well, why do we want to raise such expensive debt? Well, in hindsight, it was very cheap debt. So we were very proactive from the liquidity management perspective, and did a number of raising of capital in the markets in the summer of 2007 to term out some of our short-term funding. And in addition to that, we also had issued some contingent capital, some preferred share structures, and which actually served us very well when the losses, we started going through the losses in 2008 for our Tier 1 capital. So the combination of pre-funding or going into the market, raising additional term funding, as well as issuing some contingent capital, and all ahead of the crisis hitting, actually helped us tremendously. And one of the things that we found is that Deutsche actually was, during the crisis, we were there was a flight of capital to us, and so we actually had no problems at all during the crisis of raising money. In fact, now it wasn't like we were rolling six-month money market, you know, that the market wasn't, but during the crisis, there was a, we were turning money away, let's put it that way.
We actually had a ratings upgrade during the crisis. I was impressed.
Well,
2007.
Yeah, we might have had a downgrade, though,
we
as well.
Downgrade as well. I couldn't understand that, actually, the way it was.
Yeah. But we,
and there's recently a downgrade also, right? Because
yeah.
Of the,
yeah.
That's right. The reliance on the banking model, the investment banking.
Yeah.
Oh, really? I wondered why that was. Yeah.
But from a liquidity management, I think that would be one of the brighter stars for us in terms of what we did in ahead of the crisis.
I need to understand, please. What information went up the line to somebody who made what decision to do that?
I believe Hugo Banzinger and our group treasurer, at that time would have been Chris Whitman, were looking at what was happening in the markets and then making a conscious decision to tap the markets in the summer of 2007, as an example. And that's just, you know, it was just the discussion and dialogue and what was happening. And I can't speak specifically of, you know, who's, was it the group treasurer that said, oh, we should be going to market or not? Was it the broader board that was having these discussions? Unfortunately, not in that position. But I would suspect it would have been the group treasurer and Hugo making, you know, those decisions and recommendations to the board in terms of, you know, going to the market and raising additional term debt.
Yeah, just to note, this timing, right, coincides with the de-risking we talked about before. And the fact that these decisions would be made at the board level.
Yes.
Again, to Patrick's comment about you have to look at things vertically and horizontally. So these decisions in 2007 will be made at the board level as to how to manage and de-risk the business.
Great. That makes a lot of sense that somebody was thinking.
Yeah.
What are the implications? I'd like to go to an area that Andrew is familiar with. Are you concerned at all about cyber risks, about information system risk?
Information system risk within somebody attacking our...
For example, and then I want to go to general quality of information systems across the organization.
Yeah, I think we have whole teams responsible for looking after our data, protecting our data. I'm not an expert in that area, but I can say it's something that's clearly on the radar, and we've got people in the bank from our corporate security independent function to our IT specialists that are focused very much on these areas of protecting attacks. We've in fact we run a regular exercise for the senior management team on crisis management. We run an annual exercise, and we had one of them on the business continuity and one of the staged scenarios that they ran. I think it was. Late last year, was on exactly that, an attack on our systems and kind of what do we do and how do we respond. It's definitely in the forefront of people's minds, yes.
And what about the quality of information systems? Do people at the top, in fact, have high-quality information across the entire enterprise?
I think that they do. I think we learned some lessons during the crisis, undoubtedly, in terms of information. But the people at the top have good access to information, but they also have a lot of individuals that know their portfolios. So it's a combination of taking information and making sure that it is accurate. I mean, it should be accurate, but what we found in the crisis is that in normal times when business is going, 98-99% accuracy works really well, or that's fine. In a crisis, that doesn't work so well, right? You have to have everything absolute. So we clearly learned that you know, you also have to make sure that people look vet and make sure that everything as it's going up is accurate. So we had a couple of times where we had an exposure number where the collateral wasn't feeding exactly the way it should have, and it showed us a certain risk number that we reported, and then we determined, oh, well, that number, no, actually, the credit officer knew that we had a transaction and there was collateral. So we found a few of those things during the crisis. So I would say it works. We have good systems. It's not 100%, all the way through, and we're working on making sure. We also are working on programs now to kind of reduce the complexity of our systems and our models, because we've grown over the years We're a very global institution. We have many different business lines, and so we've grown those different systems, capturing risk and capturing in the front end and determining the risk numbers, and then our official books and records. And we're now in the process of actually looking to eliminate some of the complexity and having more of a streamlined approach rather than a bunch of things feeding pipes into different. That's where you end up having issues, is when you have a very complex organization with lots of different entry points, and making sure that you've got something you capture from the front all the way through versus plumbing that comes in, and it's in the plumbing that you end up, usually you might miss something. So I would say the systems are very good. They weren't 100% perfect by any stretch, but from a risk management perspective, the combination of the risk numbers that we had, the input that we had, and the individuals looking at it and saying, okay, that's correct, I'm verifying the accuracy of that, is what served us well during the crisis.
So you have that kind of feedback mechanism?
Oh, yeah, we had the individual feedback along with the... before it even goes up, you have individuals looking at the information and saying, does that make sense? Is there anything that's missing? Okay, and making sure that... and it wasn't 100%... it wasn't always 100% right, meaning that we learned our lessons too, that, you know, oh, we missed it on occasion and had numbers that we might have reported a much higher risk number because we didn't have a collateral fee that was offsetting that, as an example. But for the most part, the information systems are good. It certainly can be better, but they're good from a risk perspective.
And from a business perspective, I assume.
From a business perspective, but we're constantly making improvement, though. I mean, it's something that we don't take for granted. I mean, we have to constantly improve that, and that's why we have, for example, this project underway to reduce the complexity.
About how many people are in the risk function?
In the risk function?
I don't know how to quite slice it, since...
Yeah, you've got
wide or what?
Yeah, so
not counting the embedded ones in the business.
Right, so independent risk function... you have to separate, I'll start with credit as an example, you have to separate out the retail credit functions, which tend to be much more people. You know, so for example, in Germany and in retail, Italy, Spain, you probably have 3,000, 4,000 people, you know, broadly. I want to say, I can get an answer, exact answer, but it's in that range. And then in the international business, so like the wholesale investment banking on the credit side, globally there's about 700 people or so, 700 credit officer type of people. We also have a ratings team that's independent, and it's part of the risk function. There's another about 100 people or so in that area. And then in the money or in the treasury side, I would be guessing on the treasury in the U.S. it's about 55 people that we've been adding to the treasury team following the crisis to add beef up our market risk management area. I should say not treasury, money market or market risk. But I'd say globally, market risk must have a couple hundred people, 200-300 people. I have to come back to get you the exact numbers.
So order of magnitude 5,000, is that?
I would say across all of the risk areas, if you include liquidity, treasury, market risk, credit risk, if you include legal, yeah, it would probably be close to between 4,000 and 5,000 people, I'd say.
We don't need anything precise.
The nomination of how many?
There's 77,000.
That's a nice number.
The ratio between the risk number of risk people in comparison to the overall is pretty good.
On any continent, in any place, to the best of your knowledge, was there any value added from any government official?
Is that a trick question? Other than the great people in the room here. yeah, sure. I'm sure of it. Yes.
Any examples come to mind?
All of the great elected politicians of the U.S. No, I think clearly
on the technical level, but I'll settle for anything.
From a politician perspective, I don't.
Okay, go ahead.
From a regulatory, I mean,
yeah, regulatory.
You know, Dr. Ackerman is one of one of the leading voices for the banking industry as a whole, and I think he has good relationships with politicians, with obviously the German establishment, you know, in the U.S., with people like the former Secretary of Treasury. You know, he has those types of relationships. So I can't speak. I would say yes, there certainly during the crisis, there was a need to have a lot of communication across the public sector and the private sector. And I think that what people probably don't recognize, and having been in the front row, literally in the front row, watching the week evolve around Lehman, how close this, our global financial system was on the edge. And it really was close. It was scary, actually. And I know there were a lot of people that were much closer and higher up and were looking at things, but from where I sat, so I think undoubtedly the communication that took place across the private and the public sector went a long way to get things calmed down and getting things at least so the whole thing didn't tip over.
If we set the crisis aside, and let me give an example, that there was one regulator in one institution, and I went in and looked at their ratings on the risk management function. And in 2006, superb. Well, this turns out to have been an institution that took an awful lot of taxpayer money when we were done. In 2007, not quite as good. 2008, oh, gee, this isn't good at all. Mm. Well, that's not value-added because they're tracking what's going on, what we can get out of the newspapers. So I'm curious, before the crisis, and I understand the crisis, and we've read some stuff recently that reinforces everything you said,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the theory that a regulator is supposed to be sort of saying, by the way, have you paid attention to this? Here's some feedback. Here's some, any of that?
Well, we have, we've had for a number of years, we've had the Fed and the New York State bank regulators sitting in our offices. So we have had a regular interaction dialogue, and I think that there's certainly been, you know, added value in terms of you know, that discussion on issues to look at, focus at. In fairness, did they catch all the things that were happening, and did we even ourselves catch all the things that are happening? You could argue that no, a lot of things were missed. But I don't know what the right answer. I can tell you now, there is certainly a significant increase in the regulatory review of all of our business. In fact, if I just look at it, relatively speaking, in terms of the amount of time that my team spends interacting and providing input, and not just for the Fed, but, you know, for the BaFin in Germany, for the FSA in the UK, we probably spend 30-40% of our time now just addressing inquiries and issues of understanding of businesses of there's certainly a stepped up effort, I think, on the part of all the regulators to make sure that they understand and they have a good view of what's happening around the bank now. It's almost the other extreme, to be honest with you, in terms of, you know, it's swung the other way. So, and that's the biggest challenge we have, you know, just from a business model. All the changes that are going on, but just from a regulatory perspective, there's a huge increase in the amount of time to address the inquiries that are coming in from the regulators. Would that have been helpful 3 years ago? We probably would have said, well, why are you doing this? So it's hard to sit here and be a Monday morning quarterback, second guessing whether or not the regulators should have been asking more probing questions or not. I think we probably all should have been.
Okay, good. I you have been wonderful in terms of answering my questions. I think Kim has a couple more.
Sure.
You mentioned that you were responsible for hedge funds and financial institutions. What
yes.
types of financial institutions?
All financial institutions. So it would have been the banks, all the banks, all the broker dealers, all of the insurance companies, the monolines, looked after some of the real money funds as well. Some of the finance companies that were set up, the business development entities.
So when did you start to get concerned about the monoline? In particular,
The monolines, concern, the first monoline to hit the wall was ACA, and that was in the fall of 2007. So that would be the first time when it really kind of hit the attention of, when I say hit the attention, you had a monoline that had failed, and it failed fairly quickly. And it failed because their business model was, because of their weaker rating, was focused on the weaker structures. And they were able to do business in areas that other people didn't want to do business. Most of the monolines, as you know, their model had been for a number of years focused on the municipal finance side, and then they moved into the structured credit businesses because they saw that as another way to broaden and diversify their income. And depending on the monoline itself and their focus, you know, some were better than others in terms of looking after only certain higher quality assets. Others were more into subprime and but really it was the fall of 2007 when ACA quickly, their quick demise, and we were actively involved. We had put together what we call at Deutsche Bank a heat map. And this heat map, I probably shouldn't have mentioned this, but Charlie's looking at me, I'm sure. The heat map was put into place by November of 2007 with respect to our monoline exposures. And what it essentially did was it looked at every position that we had on with the monolines, and it looked at what my team put together was looking, and depending on the asset class that the monoline had exposure to, and depending on what we viewed as the financial ability, and we created this very detailed review of our monoline exposures. What we could tell you was the portfolio that they had, broadly speaking, and this evolved over the last couple of years, were they heavily exposed to subprime, as an example, Alt-A, trust preferreds, you know, CMBS, and we kind of looked and we did a heat map according to what we thought was the riskiest asset classes, i.e. the subprime mezzanine structures, and then the subprime AAAs, and then we looked at it on the other axis of, there's only a handful of monolines, so there's about eight or nine total, and we looked at our exposure relative to that, and we monthly began tracking the exposures that we had, the movements in the underlying positions and the exposures, and tracking the tiering, what we call the monolines. And so really in earnest, it was the end of 2007 that we had this in place, and we, on a monthly basis.
And were you therefore reducing your counterparty exposure to
At the
riskier monoline?
Yeah,
leaving ACA aside, they're smaller size.
Unfortunately, we had put on some hedges in the summer of 2007, CDS on the monolines. So there was some additional CDS bought on the monolines in the summer of 2007. To be very candid, by the time everything fell off with where the rest of the market kind of woke up by that point towards the end of 2007, and it was really, you know, people started to understand the magnitude of the connecting the dots between the AAA securities that they had written CDS on and their own AAA ratings. And I don't think people really, including ourselves, really understood the magnitude of what they had written in their business, the level of notionals that they had sold, and connected the dots that as these AAA securities dropped in value, their ability to honor the CDS, you know, was highly correlated. And by the time that really happened, it was really, you really couldn't do a lot. Meaning the assets that you were hedging off, and you had bought the CDS from them, were already assets that were on your books already. And so to go out, those assets were also not necessarily all liquid either. You know, you couldn't. So
they're also long dated, right?
Yeah, they're long dated, and then at that time to buy CDS in the market, spreads had already started to widen out significantly. So we did put hedges on in 2007, a couple billion of bot protection on the monolines. That was also around some hedging that we did with the monolines during that the summer of 2007 as well. One particular large trade that we had on to, in fact, the sole monoline that is still the only, you're not going to like to hear this, the only AAA rated monoline, and that's assured. So we did some hedging activity. The de-risking that I talked about, the significant de-risking, well, part of the de-risking strategy, in addition to selling assets, was also buying protection on a large portfolio of Alt-A assets from Assured. And so
they had done very little previously.
Yeah, Assured, to their credit, they actually exited writing contracts on the subprime market already, I think, in 2005. 2005, 2006, and but they did. We did do a large transaction. We did put some hedges in place against that transaction in the summer of 2007. So by the time the end of 2007 came around, when the monolines really hit the radar, it was difficult to sell assets and also to buy CDS.
And collateral calls didn't help.
There was no collateral calls. The way the monoline business worked, yeah. The way their business model is, and they were all highly rated, but yes.
So you are responsible for looking at other sorts of financial institutions which may have had lots of different types of positions which ultimately were mortgage risk, some of which had been hedged by the monoline, and then there's a question mark about whether that hedge really is creditworthy. Did you feel you had adequate information about the mortgage exposure of other financial institutions?
I think the disclosure and transparency increased significantly across the board for a lot of financial institutions. So if you go back and you look at the annual reports for most institutions around, for example, even their monoline exposures and what they had, you would have seen, I think, minimal disclosure in the 2006 timeframe, you know, December 2006. And then following what happened, disclosure levels for across the board, I mean, including Deutsche Bank, increased significantly around, because it was something the investors wanted to know. They clearly wanted to know, what was your exposure to mortgage type of risk? What was your exposure to the monolines? And so I think the transparency increased significantly after 2007. I mean, for the year end 2007, and then improved, started really probably maybe in 2007, much better in 2008 and 2009.
And was there anything in particular about transparency related to derivatives positions that were better or worse than transparency related to cash positions?
Transparency, you mean for the other institutions?
In trying to understand the mortgage exposure of other financial institutions to the extent that they had exposure through CDS, was that somehow less transparent to you than their cash exposure?
Yeah, I think I have to be careful, because my team were the individuals responsible for actually analyzing, looking at my level. I wasn't necessarily pulling out the financial statements for JP Morgan or Lehman. I would suspect, in hindsight now, if I was to go look at the financial reporting of the CDS, the derivatives versus their cash positions, I think they probably would have been not necessarily fully transparent to understand the risk of how much subprime, how much Alt-A, how much RMBS, you know. But I have to be careful, because I haven't done it personally myself and looked at that. But I would suspect that would be the case.
Going back to, you talked about something that you were directly involved in, which was looking at the BSAM hedge funds, and that your responsibility is to look at what's actually happening and also to think about the implications. So if I could start first, my recollection is that there were some Carlyle, Photos Carlyle, mortgage funds that had tremendous liquidity problems. Was that just before the Bear's problem, or was that before the Beatman problem?
It was just before Bear's problem, the broker dealer.
All right, then scratch that.
Yeah.
Getting back to the BSAM, did you see implications? Or is there anything you recall that you talked about and flagged in particular?
Before or after or during?
Once the trouble started, and I'm focusing only on BSAM,
right.
The hedge funds, and not on the 08 Bear Stearns situation.
Beyond what he's already talked about.
Well, I can give
activity in 07.
But I can
remember 07. The bank was doing a lot of things to de-risk, to increase liquidity. Beyond what he's already talked about.
In terms of the direct. At the time, of course, the natural thing that we did is we looked at, we looked at our exposures to other hedge funds that had similar type of risk and made sure that we looked at the underlying price. This would be normal course anyways, but, you know, that would be the direct, okay, let's make sure that other funds that have this type of risk in their portfolio who are obviously getting impacted at the same time with the price volatility, because the prices, you know, you remark a price on an asset, it goes through your whole portfolio. It's not like you're just doing it on that one hedge fund. So that would be one thing that we did from as it relates to the broader sector as a whole, and just making sure that we had the right marks and the right margin levels for other hedge funds. But I can tell you, following the BSAM situation, we certainly looked at, as this broader implication, okay, what does this mean to Bear as a whole and their business model? In fact, we met with the senior management up there in the fall, or late summer, maybe September of 2007. We met with head of markets and head of risk, as well as the CFO, because there had been some noise in the market that Deutsche Bank had cut was going to cut trading to Bear, which was clearly not the case, and so we actually had some phone calls and then told them absolutely not happening, and we went and met with them in person and had some conversations around the business model of Bear. And in fact, our conclusion was at the time that the issues with the asset management division of Bear was clearly going to be suffering. Clients were clearly likely going to be following the BSAM situation, likely potentially pulling balances out of the asset manager itself. And we had some broader concern around Bear as it related to the long-term business model that they had. And so if you're asking what would we do, that would be something indirect to the hedge funds, but, you know, related into the situation with BSAM and Bear itself.
Thank you. I don't feel comfortable, for obvious reasons, asking questions about Bear Stearns itself. I was more trying to get at the BSAM hedge funds and what it sort of signaled to the market and what were related events. And here's really where I was going. There are some people who that we've talked to who have wondered, is there a connection between what happened with the BSAM hedge funds and the disruption, volatility, whatever you want to call it, related to a set of macro hedge funds that happened more in August.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so
that's where I was trying to go.
I don't know the connectivity other than you're referencing to the quant meltdown in the first part of August, and I lived that as well, and that was quite an experience to see, you know, a three-day period where you saw the 1 in 10,000-year flood event occur 3 days in a row. And what we found during that period is that there were certain hedge funds that responded quicker and delevered and raised liquidity faster, and there were others that kept sticking by their models and they were slower to respond. And we saw one very large guy who we had a strong relationship in excess balances, excess margin, that was significantly eroded over that period of time. And in fact, depending if it had a fourth day, you know, that these guys would have been undoubtedly potentially knocked over. The cause of that, there's speculation that, you know, that was caused by one of the larger funds having to raise liquidity in the market, and were doing it and selling, you know, assets at a time that it didn't make sense relative to what the models were telling everybody that they should be doing. And it, you know, I've heard this kind of secondarily, that there was a potentially a large guy liquidating a portfolio that resulted in the knock-on impact to the broader market, or specifically around these long-short equity funds that were trading around models. And prop trading desk as well, including ourselves. We took our own hits in the first part of August. Our own prop trading had their hits as well.
So we've heard the same thing. You don't? Do you have any insight or
points to offer? No, I don't have anything concrete other than that. That's people trying to speculate on what was the cause of that. I think it makes sense. You know, in hindsight now, you know, and I heard that. I actually heard that. At the time, we met with one of the very large hedge funds that had a big long short equity quant fund, or a couple funds, but one of the big guys that you would know, and very smart. And the senior guy talking to us was saying that this is what the business out in the market was believed what happened. They didn't have any specific. But they thought that was what the key driver was for why the market moved the way it did.
I have only one follow-up that I would love to ask for, because you document a lot that's quite good here. And that is, if you could maybe talk with Mr. Bansinger and get us copies of statements he made early to establish this culture you've been talking about. Because what I hear is that, unlike two other examples I know well that had near-death experiences and got religion, this one sounds different. And it'd be interesting to get statements that he made either internally or externally. Frequently people go out and give talks to who knows what kind of associations or groups. To be able to get some sort of documentation or quotable aspects of the culture, if that were possible.
Yeah, we can certainly. He's pretty well known in the market. He's pretty public in terms of he's done a number of presentations. I would say we can certainly look for that.
Mm-hmm.
I would almost say that maybe it's because I grew up in it, and I grew up in the DNA, particularly when I first joined. And as an individual, he certainly has a presence about him in terms of his intellect, his business, how he organized his business. If I make a comparison to other organizations that I've worked at from a risk perspective, the bar is high. It's a very demanding place to work. Not everybody survives, but if you do survive, it means that you've done a very good job as far as doing the things, that thinking laterally, and some people, you know, so it's almost like it's ingrained in the sense of that's the way it's evolved. I'm not sure you're going to see him publicly speaking about how he's organized his risk organization. But it really is based around communication, making sure that you've got everybody connected in terms of what's going on, and on regular going, making sure that you're giving lots of training to your all the way through the organization. So just to give you an example, in the credit risk organization, when he was the chief credit officer, if you were going to get to the director level, to the managing director level, you went through what was called the Credit Risk Academy. 3 weeks. 1 week at a go, different places, and it really was not just a credit, it was really learning about the bank, the strategy, the industry as a whole, and learning lots of different things that really he wants to make sure that everybody's on a level that if he has to, that individual can be put at the board level and be able to present on a topic. So that's just an example. I know Charlie's learned as they've integrated other parts of the organization underneath Hugo. He's broadened that to the entire his now legal risk and capital. So it was. I grew up in it in the credit organization, and as he took on the broader risk functions over the last 5-6 years, the same culture is now part of the legal department, the treasury department, the market risk department, and as an example. You know, so the communication is important, the training is important, giving people the right, and it's all the way through the training. It's, you know, at the entry level, it's during, you know, the middle level, and it's, so he does a lot of things that I think he has just brought. It's not necessarily something you're going to read and say, and very well could be, but I think part of it is just how he's developed his organization.
So you don't have what one might call risk protocols that basically tell people throughout the organization sort of how they should behave with respect to risk, how they should think about it.
Well, we have lots of we have principles, we have policies, we have mission statements, we have all this, definitely. That's all part of the
that won't quite get to the
it could. His mantra is four things.
I mean, okay, I'm sorry, Bill. I mean, it's hard to sort of say a culture is a speech that someone gave and said something during a speech or a policy.
Well, that's my point. I'm not sure you're going
to. Harder to. It's the way people. The way when I have a legal question, I immediately think, what's the credit aspect of this legal question? Who in credit should I call? Who in compliance? I mean, I think that's attributable to the combined risk function. It's many different areas that fall in within Hugo, how we think about, you know, the different areas of the bank. And so it's hard to say there's going to be a document that shows up.
That's my point. There may be, but I think that's more important in terms of how we've evolved,
right,
versus something you may. There may be something in the public domain or some speech that he made, or but he's. We've evolved the way we have, clearly, from the direction that was set out in his vision and how he organized his businesses.
We have authority to get
for
the port, well,
mantra.
It's not the things that, you know, people, process, systems, and people, process, systems.
I can't measure them.
Portfolio. People, process, systems, portfolio. And the expectation is, in all four of those areas, to be successful, you have to be good and think through all of those. So you may have somebody that might be a really good portfolio credit person, but they're not going to be really successful, especially when you get to a certain level, unless you take into account the process and make sure. And you're focusing on your people and developing your people, and so it's simple, very simple, but it's driven into his management team to make sure that you're focusing on those four areas, and you're measured on how successful you are in those areas.
We have authority to get non-public documents, and then in return for a commitment of confidentiality that Brad can explain better than I can. And I'm wondering if there's a way to figure out if he came in and had a strategic document that he presented to the board that said, this is what I want to do. If there's some key document that would give us that picture, that would be helpful. And we can write a formal letter, but I'm wondering if we can't go back and forth first to, because we really don't want to get 800 pages. But to understand if there isn't some, you know, one or two key documents, or, you know, up to 50 pages, I don't know what the number is, I'll take more, I read, that would help us understand the underlying strategic concept for the risk function.
Yeah, we can see what we can find. My point to you is I believe this is something that has evolved. As he has evolved in his role and became the chief credit officer for the bank, like in the 1997 or 8, took over that responsibility, and then as his organization developed, you know, he would say, oh, you know, we should be focusing on this and this. And then probably by early 2000s in the credit organization, the framework of all these things about communication, about how you should be thinking laterally, the actual regular calls that were taking place, the establishment of the group credit policy committee that reviews, you know, all these different things were part of his evolution, and I think it was pretty well entrenched in the credit side probably by the early 2000s.
That would be actually more important in a sense, because that's your stepping off point to the bubble and to
right.
the whole concept that at a critical point you de-risked. But if you could just look and let us know what there is that would be helpful, and again, we can send you a confidentiality agreement, whatever, but it's more trying to sort of supplement what you said. This has been very informative, but for example, you weren't able to really tell us the interactions to the supervisory board. The way that works. Then there may be things that we can learn about his conception of the structure. And again, the early 2000s would be more relevant to us than maybe his initial ideas in the 90s. Whatever works. I don't even know how to ask the question.
That's okay. Well, let me see if there's something that can help. I think you're interested to see how we differentiated ourselves maybe in the structure and the mindset, maybe in some other
institutions. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. I've looked at, I guess you guys are number 9 now, and there's a real distinction between the ones at the top and the rest of them. So it would be quite helpful.
Okay.
Ma'am?
Please. Oh, you could have any time.
Good afternoon, Mr. McKenna. I've looked at my watch and realized it's already afternoon. I'll try to be brief. There were a couple times today you mentioned no one estimated the problem, no one expected the problem, meaning the financial crisis being as big as it did. Did you have any sense in 2007 when you were doing your analysis of the risk, did you have any sense of how many subprime and Alt-A mortgages existed in the entire marketplace?
Back at that point
mm-hmm.
in time? No.
I
wouldn't, me personally, no.
If we've seen evidence, I've read. Sorry, go ahead.
Deutsche had, of course, people who focused exclusively on the housing market and
mm-hmm.
research analysts, you know, Karen Weaver, as an example, who that was her focus, and I'm sure she had written. Quite a bit of research material around the housing market on the subprime Alt-A. So
mm-hmm.
there are individuals within Deutsche itself who would have been specialized. But me personally, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that the Alt-A market was X-size or the subprime market was. I had some knowledge of the markets and how it was developing, and knew that the market had picked up significantly, you know, over several years prior to 2007.
Post-crisis, there's been evidence to suggest that half of the mortgages outstanding in the marketplace leading into the crisis were subprime or Alt-A, far more than many of the housing experts had anticipated. Had you known in early 2007 that there were that many subprime and Alt-A mortgages outstanding, would that have factored into your decision-making process in terms of reducing risk throughout your firm?
I would say yes. It'd be easy for me to say that now, of course. I would say it would likely have had an impact, although what I don't think people understood was the extent that you had subprime and Alt-A, which was certainly a growing asset class, and you could have seen that, to the extent that the actual underlying support, you know, of these mortgages, you know, the liar loans, and I don't think anybody had any extent to the fact that a lot of the subprime and even Alt-A had challenged underwriting at that point.
Now, as I said at the outset, we're investigating the causes of the financial crisis. if this were a trial, I wouldn't be able to ask you the ultimate question, because I would get an objection that this goes to the ultimate question. I can't ask whether someone's guilty or innocent. But this isn't a trial, and this isn't a deposition. I'd be interested to know what you view from your vantage point as Chief Risk Officer of the Americas, the causes or contributing factors to the financial crisis.
I think there's a number of things that led up to and contributed. Excess leverage across the board, by the banks themselves, but just broadly, the excess leverage that crept into the system, the levels of leverage that were employed for the leverage market, leverage finance market, the commercial real estate market, the leverage that was employed by the hedge funds, so leverage would have to be right up close to the top. The fact that the banking model had shifted to a originate and distribute model, which was very dependent on the ability to distribute, and somewhat of a misperceived reality on liquidity. And liquidity, I think, was underestimated in terms of how quickly liquidity could leave the market. That was certainly contributed, but I would say leverage contributed. Transparency certainly contributed in terms of lack thereof of transparency, of really understanding some of the fine nuances of what was out there and the exposures that counterparties had.
And if I may stop you there, transparency in the instruments like structured products, or where do you mean transparency?
I would say in a combination of transparency in understanding the quality of the assets, really. In addition to that, transparency around understanding who had those exposures, where those exposures were. I think the other contributing factor was the over-dependence on short-term funding for a lot of entities that were set up for the purposes of really doing what I would call the carry trade. They could put on a long-term asset and then fund it through, you know, commercial paper, so all the SIVs and the special purpose entities that were established, and you know, clearly that created a big issue around the markets when the short-term funding couldn't get rolled and all these long-term assets had to be sold. Certainly put pressure on asset prices, broadly speaking, but that clearly contributed to the crisis. Over-dependence, perhaps, on models in terms of calculating exposures. Not to say that contributed per se, but it gave a false sense that the real risk that you were running was manageable, and that you didn't necessarily, most firms and risk managers didn't necessarily focus on the outright notional size of the positions that were there, but were focused on what they thought the perceived risk was of default and recovery. I would say on the regulatory side, clearly, you know, the front end of the mortgage market not having been regulated at all was a contributing factor to the crisis. You could argue the excess fiscal stimulus that we may have had, broadly speaking, and the imbalances. And these are all things, of course, I'm talking to you today about, not sitting in the throes of it saying, hey, there's an imbalance of our fiscal policies right now, or there's... But in hindsight, looking at the lessons learned, I think these are some of the contributing factors and then finally, I would say there may not always have been the best alignment of incentives for the risk that was being put on and understanding clearly of that risk. And, you know, the monolines is another classic example of that. The accounting that you have also needs to be, you know, you saw lots of issues around what incentivized people to do business from an accounting perspective. So I think, broadly speaking, those are the main contributors, I would say, to the crisis.
Now, you mentioned accounting. There are some who have argued that fair value and mark-to-market accounting contributed to the crisis. Did fair value accounting rules create any difficulty for Deutsche Bank, and what challenges did Deutsche Bank face in terms of marking assets to market?
I think we face the same challenge as everybody else, where we clearly found certain products became overnight illiquid, and then the question is, how do you value that? We certainly had our same issues as a lot of other firms. We also found certain products. We have, and this is in the public record, we had a significant number of our trading positions that were moved from our trading book into our banking book, part of the IAS 39. And again, in the public record, you can see that. And we clearly did that for the reason that the underlying assets fundamentally were sound assets. It's just that the market prices has, with everything else, had been dropping significantly and wasn't necessarily reflective of the underlying value that we thought. So we certainly had our challenges, like everybody else did.
Subsequent to the crisis, the SEC came out with guidance with FASB on mark-to-market accounting on September 30th, 2008, describing what constituted an orderly market and trying to provide guidance to firms. If that guidance had been issued sooner, would that have assisted Deutsche Bank in its decisions in terms of marking? Do you have any sense of whether there was guidance missing from the marketplace, in other words, from the regulators, from FASB, from the SEC, in terms of mark-to-market accounting during or leading up to the crisis?
I'm not really in a position to be able to address that. I mean, I can't say if there's not people within our organization at the senior level, the CFO or otherwise, who may have felt that way. So I'm not really in a position to be able to address that. I mean, personally, I'm agnostic to that because I couldn't say either way whether or not the guidance would have helped or not.
Were there assets that you were involved in marking down that ultimately were proved to yield cash flows and ultimately got marked back up?
There were, what we have found is that there have been assets that we have marked down in our trading book and that we still have, some of our legacy assets that in the first quarter of this year we were able to actually sell at a higher price. We didn't mark them back up. We actually sold them because we were in the process of de-risking and reducing our legacy assets. I'm not aware of where we've marked up our assets significantly. But if there is, if there's assets on our balance sheet and we have a price in the market from an asset that we've sold, we very well could have marked up portfolio. But I don't believe we are actively or aggressively marking up our portfolio at this point in time. It's still...
We've talked to a number of folks at Deutsche Bank concerning the mortgage purchasing side. Deutsche Bank used a due diligence firm called Clayton Holdings. Did you, sir, have any interactions with Clayton Holdings?
No, I did not.
In and around September 2007, we've heard that Clayton had a meeting with Deutsche Bank where they presented an exception summary report. Did those reports ever reach your level?
No, I didn't have responsibility at that point in time for the securitization portfolio. I took that on afterwards. That was not until first part of 2009 that I took the securitization responsibility. So I would have, somebody in the organization may have been aware of that, but I was not personally.
We learn a lot by determining what we would have done in hindsight. In hindsight, were there any tools that were available in the marketplace that you wish you had had as risk officer of Deutsche Bank that now in hindsight you can identify? In other words, looking back, were there tools that existed in the marketplace that you didn't have that now you wish you had had?
I don't know if there's any tools per se. There's certain things that obviously you could have done differently and would have done differently. You know, as an example, as I mentioned, there was a focus on the risk side, particularly around looking at what you would consider, you know, what was at risk at default. And if you had a secured asset and you had a high rating, you would have expected, okay, the likelihood of risk is this. Getting back to common sense and basics, the outright notional size of a lot of these businesses that were out there, you know, would have been a good indicator to say, hey, look, this is, you know, you've got to take the whole notional also in context, not just the risk that you think you have. And I think that lesson clearly, you know, something that most of the banks learned, hopefully learned.
There have been some suggestions that the interconnectedness of the investment banking system and the commercial banking system, for that matter, caused or contributed to the financial crisis. Is there any evidence in terms of your experience with interconnectedness that you point to as causing or creating any problems during the crisis with Deutsche Bank?
I think it's obviously a key issue in terms of the interconnectedness and just the, particularly for the larger investor banks, in terms of the trading that takes place. You know, arguably you could say, well, it's all on a collateralized basis, but when you go into a crisis and the knock-on impact that has with a large counterparty like Lehman, for example, going under, what that did to the broader market and the confidence issue. So, you know, clearly, I actually, as I mentioned before, had responsibility for the FI sector and was one of the main people helping manage through the week of Lehman and through the whole financial crisis. But what we saw with Lehman, for example, was when they filed bankruptcy, the broader market, and then AIG was right on the heels of that, but the broader market became very concerned about who was the next entity that was going to fall over. And so where you really saw this interconnectedness, and what I don't think people really appreciate necessarily, I'm sure you do and others, but most people, is that we have a system of cash payments that takes place on a global basis that is huge. And that business takes place daily with trillions of dollars that are passing through this interconnected system, that if you start to lose confidence that this bank may not be in a position where, and most of that is overdraft, intraday overdraft, where at the end of the day you settle up, if you're short 100 or 200, you know, you lend that money out to them, you're fine. But if you have a system where you don't have the confidence that entity is going to make it, you're more reluctant to give them that type of credit. And then if you think about everybody doing that at the same time, everybody contracting at the same time, that's where you have this potential where the whole thing knocks over. And the interconnectedness is clearly very apparent. We saw that, you know, following Lehman. We saw certain institutions that actually, one I won't name, but who actually did not make a payment to an entity, to another bank, to us, for another bank, where we were their Euroclear, and we had a significant shortfall overdraft, nearly $2 billion, at the end of the business day. And that's an unsecured risk, by the way. If that entity files for bankruptcy, you're getting cents on the dollar as an unsecured creditor. But what happened was another institution was waiting to the last minute, and they were waiting for payments to come in, and the payments did come in, but the wire had shut the equivalent, and they couldn't get the payment out. So now you have, you know, this overdraft. And so my point of mentioning that is that if you lose that confidence with that interconnectedness as far as our cash system, you know, and everybody does this, you create the potential of having a real serious issue. And that started to happen a bit the week of Lehman, and you saw more and more institutions kind of tightening up. other ways in terms of just trading broadly as far as distributing risk. You know, a lot of the bank model moved to acting as an intermediary and not necessarily putting on big risk for themselves, but being on different sides of trades. And if you are on one side and you're buying, you know, the same from another large institution, well, of course, you're expecting them to be there to be able to now. Normally that works if you're taking cash collateral in, if the position's in your favor. The real issue is that when the large entity goes away, that the gapping and where prices go creates big swings in terms of, well, you may have been fully capable of managing that, the knock-on impact of that into, you know, to asset prices into the broader market may result in a series of other entities having problems. So the interconnectedness is probably, in my mind, more relevant than the size of an institution. Meaning everybody says too big to fail, too interconnected to fail.
Like many Americans, I read The Big Short. One of the protagonists is Deutsche Bank employee, Greg Lipman.
I don't know if I would say he's a protagonist. That was your interpretation?
No,
well,
seriously. He had a significant mention in the book, I should say.
He did. I don't think he was, in my view, I didn't read it as him as a protagonist, to be honest.
What role or what interaction did you have with Greg Lipman?
I interacted with Greg on occasion. He was involved in the Bear Stearns, the BSAM funds, because it was his desk that originally, I think, had a relationship with the Bear Stearns funds. He would occasionally, for new business, would call to get to talk about margin levels that we're setting for clients, and so my interaction was probably most around the Bear Stearns funds. That's when I really first met Greg, and then on occasion I would interact with him on business, new business. And then we also had some interactions around when one of the when Peloton, one of the funds, had their issues as well. Mm-hmm. So I would talk to Greg, and then we'd also have Greg occasionally present a couple of times to the hedge fund team about what was going on in the market, his view of the broader market, along with Karen Weaver, just to keep the team educated broadly on what was happening in the RMBS space.
Well, that leads me to my next question is Mr. Lipman has been portrayed as being very bearish on the housing market and leading up to the crisis, and that was his business. How much did his views factor into the overall risk management decisions at your level?
He's one individual in the firm, right? And he clearly was bearish. As a risk manager, you're more natural to go with the bearish view. I mean, at least maybe I'm wrong on that, but so did he have an influence? I wouldn't say he had a undue influence, although he would have certainly been a data point, being bearish on the market. Karen Weaver had more of an influence as an independent research person who provided a similar view to the market and was probably early versus most in the market in terms of her negative view of the housing market. That would have a bearing as well. So we read the Deutsche Bank research, and I would say probably more of an influence from Karen Weaver than from Greg Lipman.
In the book, and forgive me, I don't get all of my information or sources from popular books or the newspapers, but in the book it's portrayed as Mr. Lipman on one side and the CDO guys at Deutsche Bank on the other side. Did there ever come a time where you saw what Lipman was doing and the positions he was taking contrary to the market and go to the CDO side and say, wait a second here, why are we taking on so much exposure on CDOs? Particularly when guy over here is taking a very contrary position on the housing market. Did that ever come up? Did any event like that ever come
up? No, it didn't come up. I mean, the CDO business as a whole was built again around a originate-distribute type of model, which would have been, you know, different than what a trader would have in terms of his view of the market. So it wouldn't necessarily be, oh, these guys are, the model wasn't, oh, put on a bunch of CDOs on Deutsche's balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go long on that. It would have been more in the warehousing of assets and then the distribution that you probably would have had a difference between the trader having a negative view, perhaps. But they are separated, and whether or not that ever got filtered up at a different level within the business itself, I can't tell you. But I knew Greg was very bearish on the market. Everybody knew that. I think he was very vocal publicly in the market on that point. We knew Karen Weaver was very bearish as well on the housing market because she did a lot of research. How that connected, I think it's the CDO business was around originating structuring transactions and distributing, not necessarily seeing an outright view of piling up on CDOs. So the fact that we had long positions when the music stopped was not necessarily reflective of, you know, these guys were bullish and this guy was bearish.
Understand. On your warehouse lines to mortgage originators, did you have any involvement with those lines in any way?
I had one involvement when I, before I went to Barclays Capital, I took over the regional head of credit. So this is back in probably late 2003-ish, I'd say, because I went to Barclays 2004 March. I took over responsibility as the regional role, which included the securitization business from a credit perspective. And my interaction was actually on one transaction that I was brought into, an approval transaction. It was actually a purchase of a billion-dollar whole loan purchase. And it was a bit eye-opening for me because I had been in the securitization market at the very inception of the market back in the late 80s for the first two deals that got done in the market. I won't bore you with the details, but that was at the time when letters of credit were provided to enhance structure, and the market evolved many, many times since then. But what surprised me in my interaction was, this was a purchase of a whole loan portfolio, and what was driven off of was clearly a spreadsheet that looked at diversification, looked at yields on the portfolio, looked at FICO score averages, and looked at, I think, estimated prepayment speeds throughout portfolios. And then the question was, how much did you bid, you know, on that portfolio? You pay 102 cents on the dollar, you pay 102.3, depending on how you thought you were going to restructure this. And that's why I say it was my only interaction on the whole loan side, that one transaction, and then I subsequently joined Barcap. Didn't have responsibility, but that was it.
Did the, from a risk management point of view, did the information gleaned from the folks at Deutsche Bank who handled warehouse lines, who were involved in the securitization desk, who were involved in purchasing, did that, in essence, go up the chain the same way that information from the CEO desk went up the chain to one point? And where did it meet from a risk management standpoint, at your level, or was there someone under you?
Let me make sure I understand the question. You're saying within the origination of the CDO business,
mm-hmm.
and the approval process, mm-hmm. versus the
RMBS side.
Yeah.
Let me put an example on this. We've heard instances where some financial institutions were taking one action, like a very bearish action on the RMBS side, while taking a very bullish action at the same time on the CDO side. In essence, one hand was doing one thing, one hand was doing the other thing. Very contrary positions. My question is, was there someone at Deutsche Bank, and would that have been you, that would have been looking at what was going on the RMBS side what was going on with mortgage purchasing, what was going on with the warehouse lines and the securitization, and also looking at the same time what was going on the CDO side and what sort of warehouse limits were being taken on the CDO side. Was there someone overseeing both of those activities? Would it have been you, someone reporting under you?
No, it would have been through, not at my level. Again, at that time, I wasn't, the structure was a little different.
Mm-hmm.
But the approval or sign-off for the warehouse lines would have been likely our head of securitization credit at the time. And then you had somebody on the credit risk side that was responsible for the establishment of the warehouse limits. And then in terms of just positions that we're putting on, if they were prop positions or views, that would have been done through the market risk side of the firm in terms of setting out the outright depth limits that they could have around those portfolios. So they may not have gone up to the same individual depending on if it was a trading position that was put on versus a warehouse facility that was getting put in place for a client.
But ultimately, someone in risk would have seen both sides of the picture.
They would have seen what limits we had in place for market risk,
mm-hmm.
And they would have seen the limits that we had in place for the warehouse facilities, as an example.
And how? What I'm trying to get a sense of is
just to add something. I mean, all these businesses you're mentioning, whether it's RMBS, CDOs, CDS trading, all those businesses within the same business area of the bank, which was Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm. Right,
so
I'm sorry.
It's all in the same umbrella.
And Lippman would have been there too?
Yeah.
So the people, all those folks are reporting up to the same management chain.
Right. I thought you meant from the independent risk function. You would have had somebody responsible for signing off on the warehouse lines, as an example. Which would have been different than somebody signing off on positions that somebody had on the trading desk.
Sure. And what I'm trying to get a sense of, I guess, is where did these all meet together in terms of independent risk? Would it have been at the independent risk officer for the investment bank? Would it have been someone lower? Where does this flow in terms of the independent risk?
Well, it would have gone, the trading book would have been up through the head of market risk.
Mm-hmm.
The credit risk or the warehouse facilities would be up through the credit division, and ultimately it would be the chief risk officer.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it depends on how the information was presented as well. Would they have been presented together to say we've got this and this? They would have shown the risk limits, but I don't know if necessarily they'd say, oh, by the way, these are interconnected. You know, they're not. But it would have ultimately gone up with, these are our market risk limits around this product. This is our warehousing lines that we have for now. At the time, I believe the market risk and the credit. This is, I'm trying to think the timeline. We at one point merged the securitization risk management team to eliminate the market risk versus the credit risk, and we put the team under one individual. And I think it was probably after the crisis hit.
It'd be interesting to know if that happened before or after.
I'm sure it happened after the crisis, for sure.
Did it happen as a result of the crisis or just the downsizing of the business and everything?
No, it was definitely a result of wanting to get more better information.
Got it. Just have one or two more. You mentioned in spring 2007 you did a comprehensive review of the risk and you made certain adjustments. What did you view at that time in spring of 2007 as the greatest risks posed to Deutsche Bank?
So when you say I did a comprehensive review of the risk, I'm not sure if
you'd mentioned at the outset a review of sorts that you did in spring of 2007. And you said we started, you know, making adjustments to our risk and our risk exposure.
What we would have done already starting probably around April timeframe when there was increasing uncertainty around the residential market, is looking at our margin levels that we were charging to the hedge fund clients, and reassessing the prices and the volatility and whether or not we had the right margin level. So we would have started to look not just on the RMBS space, but that was what led, I think, the beginning of looking at structured credit as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at margin levels that we had established, and a lot of that you just look at historic information and then you're constantly looking at it, but I think we took a close look and made some adjustments, first of many over the next 2 years,
mm-hmm.
but adjustments in our margin haircuts that we would charge the clients for structured credit as an example.
Mm-hmm. Now, I presume that your assessment of where your risk resided changed over time, leading up to and throughout the crisis, but focusing just at that initial stage of April, May 2007, where did you initially view your greatest risks?
You have to remember I was responsible for the hedge fund portfolio, so that was my focus, and so I can't speak for the bank as a whole, but I would say, clearly the view from where I sat was to make sure that the hedge fund portfolio was adequately margined and that we were on top of the risk that was evolving in the portfolio. So I'd have to say that would be my primary focus at that point in time.
Sure. And you wouldn't then be in a position to say what the bank's biggest focus was?
What I can tell you is we started in the spring of 2007 within the global markets division, where a lot of the structured credit businesses had been structured and where our balance sheet had actually grown considerably. We started to de-risk in the spring of 2007, and it was clear, that we needed to go and reduce our exposures to the structured credits that we had on around RMBS. We made a conscious decision. We had bought Mortgage IT, you're probably familiar with that, in January 2007. That was a mortgage originator. The idea at the time, prior to that, like other banks, is that we needed to get product. We needed to have a vertically integrated business. Talk about bad timing. And that business actually was significantly wound down even early on. They moved away from, for example, almost immediately away from underwriting any subprime assets. And in fact, they continued to do Alt-A assets, but even that was significantly reduced, over 2007. So what you saw from a business perspective, you saw a significant conscious decision to move away from, on the origination side, the RMBS business. And we significantly reduced that business even in the first year that we had it from a headcount perspective and from just what we did. So, the intent was to use that as a basis to kind of continue on our development and leverage off our securitization expertise. And again, because of the situation in the market, we were pretty quick to exit that business outright. So that's an example of the focus of the institution of, conscious decision on risk in the portfolio.
Great. Is there anything else that you expected us to talk about that we didn't? Is there any topic that we've overlooked in our very long but very productive conversation with you?
No, I can't think of anything. I mean, did I expect? I didn't really have a lot to expect. I appreciate the time, but I think you've covered a lot.
Well, we appreciate your time. If there's anything after this conversation you think of that you think is just helpful for us to understand, either the marketplace as a whole, risk management, or your firm, Deutsche Bank, if you could just let one of your counsel know and they'll get the word to us if there's anything that you think of that might be useful for us to understand. We appreciate your insights. It's been very helpful. It's very productive.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. We're going off record at 106.
Yeah. Thank you.
Just Nick?
You're off.